All right, welcome back, everybody. Ms. Fury, did you want to call your next witness?
Yes, Your Honor. At this time, we'd like to call Mr. Dustin Jones.
All right. Mr. Jones, are you there? If you want to unmute.
I am. Can you hear me, Your Honor?
I can, and I can see you, so great. Mr. Jones, before you testify today, I am required by law to advise you on the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
I do, Your Honor.
And being advised on the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Fury.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, can you please introduce yourself to the commission?
Sure. My name is Dustin Jones. I'm an Environmental Services Project Manager with NextEra Energy Resources and the Environmental Lead for Northern Divide Wind's proposed wind and transmission project. I oversaw and managed third-party consultants and the related environmental studies for the project, specifically studies for wetlands, land use, wildlife, cultural resources, architectural history, and acoustic and shadow flicker modeling.
Thank you. And can you please briefly describe your educational and professional background?
I received my Bachelor of Science in Wildlife and Fisheries Sciences from Texas A&M University, and I'm a certified wetland delineator. I have over 18 years of environmental permitting experience in the renewable industry, including the permitting and licensing of projects on private land in compliance with federal and state regulations.
And are you familiar with the project's applications and supporting materials which are marked as Exhibits 1 through 21?
Yes, I am.
And did you submit pre-filed testimony to the commission?
Yes, my pre-filed testimony was submitted to the commission on April 1st and is marked as Exhibit 7.
And do you have a copy of Exhibit 7 before you?
I do.
And is this exhibit a correct copy of your April 1st pre-filed testimony?
Yes. However, I have two updates to my testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it is a correct copy.
And is it an accurate representation of what your testimony would be if you were to give your testimony orally before the commission?
It is. However, I have two updates to my testimony. The first update is on page 15. Line 9, and it's related to grassland. I would like to clarify that no above-ground wind project infrastructure is located within unbroken grassland. The word above-ground was inadvertently omitted. There are minimal temporary impacts to non-native unbroken grassland from collection lines that will be restored following construction. The second update is related to historic resources. On page 18 through 20, I describe potential indirect viewshed impact from the wind project to two historic resources, the South St. Olaf's Church and the Niels Nielsen 14-sided barn. And our coordination with the North Dakota State Historical Preservation Office regarding proposed mitigation efforts for these sites. Subsequent to the filing of my testimony, the SHPO has now concurred with our mitigation proposal on April 3rd, 2020. This concurrence is marked as Exhibit 21.
Thank you. And in developing the Northern Divide Wind Project, did Northern Divide Wind address the environmental and wildlife concerns that were previously identified for the Burke Wind Project by the Commission, North Dakota Game and Fish, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes. Northern Divide Wind worked extensively with the wildlife agencies to revise the wind project and address concerns previously identified by the wildlife agencies. Through that coordination, we reduced the wind project over 50% from 22,933 acres to 10,912 acres. We shifted the wind project to a predominantly agricultural landscape that consists of only 7% unbroken grassland. We have sited all turbines, access roads, and the substation in tilled cropland. We've sited all wind project infrastructure to avoid wetland impacts. we relocated 44 and eliminated 3 of the prior 81 Burke wind project turbines, including the 11 easternmost turbines, which the wildlife agencies opined were the most critical to relocate. We have sited all turbines in low waterfowl nest density areas, including that of the northern pintail duck, which was a species specifically requested by the wildlife agencies. We've increased the number of proposed turbines to be located outside of the Missouri Coteau from 3 to 20, and NextEra as a company is committed to avoid further development of wind generation projects in the northern Missouri Coteau. Attachment 1 and 2 to my pre-filed testimony provide a detailed timeline outlining noteworthy consultation efforts with both wildlife agencies and a list of Northern Divide Wind's proposed mitigation measures for both projects.
And are the projects sited in or do they consist of areas that are otherwise considered unique because of their biological wealth?
No, through Northern Divide Wind's siting efforts, which included close coordination with the wildlife agencies, the projects are sited in or include areas commonly found in North Dakota, such as landscapes dominated by agricultural land uses.
And will the projects have minimal adverse effects on the environment and wildlife?
Yes. Balancing state and local setbacks, wind resource availability, constructability, and landowner preference, Northern Divide Wind developed the projects respective of the mitigation hierarchy, which in order of priority consists of, first, avoiding impacts, two, minimizing unavoidable impacts, three, restoring impacted areas, and four, offsetting any residual impacts. Avoidance of environmental and wildlife impacts or excluding certain habitats was our priority, such as wetlands and native unbroken grasslands. When avoidance was not possible or practical, we minimized impacts such as spanning native unbroken grasslands with the transmission project. For any temporarily impacted areas, we will restore the area to pre-impact conditions. We feel these measures effectively result in minimal adverse impacts to the environment and wildlife. However, as an additional measure, we have voluntarily committed to habitat restoration and offsets for potential indirect impacts to avian species. Furthermore, in recent correspondence for the North Dakota Game and Fish Department dated March 17, 2020, which is marked as Exhibit 13, the department acknowledged that Northern Divide Wind's efforts have resulted in significant impact avoidance and minimization.
And can you please provide additional detail regarding Northern Divide Wind's voluntary commitment to provide habitat offsets?
Yes. Our primary objective is to comply with the Commission's siting criteria, which Northern Divide Wind accomplishes through the avoidance, minimization, and restoration measures outlined in my pre-file testimony and described above. Although indirect impacts are not a specific siting criteria, we understand they are a factor the Commission considers in evaluating an application. Therefore, in response to concerns identified by the wildlife agencies regarding potential indirect impacts to grassland nesting birds and waterfowl, Northern Divide Wind has committed to restoring or recreating 196 wetland acres and 100 native grassland acres. This commitment is memorialized in a memorandum of understanding executed between Northern Divide Wind and the North Dakota Game and Fish Department, which is marked as Exhibit 13.
And does the wind project comply with the Commission's 50 dBA and Burke County's 49 dBA sound level criteria and the Commission's accepted standard of 30 hours per year of shadow flicker?
Yes. Northern Divide Wind sound and shadow flicker models predicted levels are well below these criteria. The maximum predicted sound level is 48 dBA at a participating residence, and all non-participating receptors are predicted to be 45 dBA or less. The maximum predicted shadow flicker is 22 hours per year, or less than 1% of the average annual daylight hours, and this is at a participating residence. All non-participating receptors are predicted to be 17 hours per year or less of shadow flicker.
The State Water Commission provided two letters on the project, one on September 19th, 2019, and another on April 3rd, 2020. What is the difference in these letters?
In the September 2019 letter, which is located in attachment C.8 of exhibits 1 and 2, the Water Commission stated there are no floodplains in the project. But in the April 2020 letter, which is marked as exhibit 20, the Water Commission now states there may be floodplains and to work closely with the local floodplain administrators. Based on this information, Northern Divide Wind contacted the Water Commission to seek clarity. Per the Water Commission, they are changing how they respond to large projects that span multiple jurisdictions and are providing a less definitive comment on floodplain status and are recommending applicants coordinate with local floodplain administrators if one is available in those jurisdictions and if floodplains are present. Therefore, Northern Divide Wind rechecked the latest regulatory floodplain information, and as described in the applications, there are no mapped federal regulatory 100-year floodplains in the project. Although we do not anticipate any floodplain issues, we are working on other matters with the county emergency manager, who often acts as the local floodplain administrator for most rural jurisdictions, and we will consult for the Water Commission's recommendation.
In your opinion, has Northern Divide Wind cited the projects in a manner so that their location and operation will produce minimal adverse effects on the environment, wildlife, and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
Yes, for the reasons I've outlined in my pre-file testimony and described above.
And does this conclude your direct testimony?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Schmidt, do you have any questions for Mr. Jones?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Mr. Jones.
Good afternoon, Mr. Schmidt.
So in your pre-filed testimony, I want to, and this is exhibit number 7, I want to go right to page 8. And there's a table on page 8, and I'll let you flip to that and let me know when you're there.
I'm there.
And it's right after, it's between lines 3 and lines 4. And this table appears to be a comparison between the Burke Wind project and the current project that's been submitted for an application. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So in looking at this table, it appears that the current project encompasses 52% less area than the Burke Wind project. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And in that reduction, there are fewer wetlands that are located within the new project area proposal that were proposed in the Burke project, correct?
That is correct.
The term that I see on this table is wetland features. You use it a few different times. Question is, within the scope of this table, what do you consider to be a wetland feature?
So for the scope of this table, based on the footnote below at the end of the table, we use what's called the National Wetland Inventory data because we don't delineate or map every project physically within each project area. We use a landscape scale data set to make that comparison.
So whatever the National Wetland Inventory, maps or data indicated to you, you use that as the basis for declaring whether something was or was not a wetland feature?
Well, that for the comparison of differences between the two projects. When we do field surveys, our consultants do what's called a delineation to determine if the NWI layer is correct or needs to be updated. So we follow certain delineation procedures and map the accurate boundary of wetlands.
Were you involved in those field delineation procedures?
Not me personally, but I oversaw the consultants that did those.
And if we looked at the field delineation procedures, would the numbers as a result of actual study on the ground differ from what you have in your table?
It would not, because like I said, we don't map every wetland on the ground. We only map wetlands that are going to be within our potential construction footprint to determine areas to avoid.
In this table, it indicates that 10% of the current project area contains wetland features. Is that correct? Is that your testimony?
That's a good approximation based on the National Wetland Inventory data.
And 1,261 acres of wetland features are located within 0.5 miles of a turbine location. Is that also correct?
That is correct.
Are you familiar with the term prairie pothole region?
I am.
And is the prairie pothole region located in the same area where this project is proposed to be located?
The prairie pothole region is a very large geographic region that extends from Canada down into South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota. And the project is located within an area defined as the prairie pothole region.
What are the features of the prairie pothole region?
It's simply just, most people describe it as a landscape of grasslands and wetland mosaic. And then I think that's probably the most simplest way to define it is that's the general term that people consider. I would add that, a large portion of it now has been manipulated through agriculture. I'd say about 75% of the prairie pothole region has been affected in some way by tillage.
And the term Northern Missouri Coteau has been used throughout both the last hearing as well as what's your understanding of the Northern Missouri Coteau?
Yes, sir. So the larger Missouri Coteau, again, is another large geographic region kind of within the prairie pothole region. And it also extends from Canada down through North Dakota into South Dakota and Iowa. The Northern Missouri Coteau is a subdivision of that up in the northwest part of North Dakota, extending into Montana and Canada.
And what are some of the features of the Missouri Coteau and specifically the Northern Missouri Coteau?
They're very similar. The difference is, I think, water regime is what kind of separates it. As you go into the Northern Missouri Coteau, I'd probably have to get some more information, but I understand that you get into a different water regime and you also have different vegetation. You tend to get more trees and shrubs in the Northern Missouri Coteau than you do in the larger Missouri Coteau to the south.
And overall, with the combination of the prairie pothole region and the Missouri Coteau overlapping with the project area, are these geographic regions important for the growth and development of wildlife?
It's part of many wildlife, for example, avian species, it's part of their migration corridor, which extends from the Gulf Coast up through Canada. And I would say, yes, it's an important component. There are definitely areas within the Missouri Coteau that are more important to wildlife than others. Like I said, there's large areas that have been impacted by agriculture that are less favorable for wildlife.
How would you describe the project area as far as being important to the growth and development of wildlife?
I'd say through our coordination with the wildlife agencies, as we were looking to relocate the project, we identified areas from the Old Burke project that were more important to wildlife, and we excluded those and moved into areas that were less suitable, because we're about 64% agriculture in the Northern Divide project area. So we have areas that are less important to wildlife because they're either cropland or other types of agriculture.
I want to go back to your chart. On page 8 of your pre-filed testimony, and I'm looking specifically at the fifth line of the chart, and it states wetland impacts, permanent or temporary, then there's a parenthesis AC, and then it says Burke Wind Project, 0, Wind Project, 0, decrease percentage, 0. I guess my first question is, what is a temporary impact to wetlands?
A temporary impact could be you're trenching a collection line across a wetland, and you then restore it when you're done. So the collection line goes underground, and then when you're done, you restore the surface. So that'd be a temporary impact. There's no permanent infrastructure like a road or a turbine foundation that stays in the wetland.
Okay, and then what's a permanent impact to wetlands?
Kind of like I described, it's an impact such as a road or a turbine foundation that replaces an area of the wetland.
So the way I'm understanding your testimony is unless some piece of infrastructure actually physically touches the wetland, it's not considered an impact. Is that your testimony?
If it's a permanent above ground infrastructure, you can still have a temporary impact, like I said, through collection. So you could touch it, but it would be temporary, and then it would be restored back to its pre-impact condition.
And are you talking about direct impacts or indirect impacts to the wetlands with your statement in your table up there?
I'm talking about direct impacts.
So what is a, in your opinion, what is the difference between a direct impact and an indirect impact to a wetland?
Sure. A direct impact would be something, let's say you fill 1 acre of a 10-acre wetland with a turbine base. That would be a direct impact. An indirect impact is something that would be measured, you know, over time. So maybe there's some erosion that takes place off of the, you know, 10 years down the road, and you get some sediment that washes down into the wetland. I would consider that an indirect impact from, you know, improper sedimentation controls or something like that. So you could have a downstream effect, but it's not directly related to, you know, you replacing a certain area of that wetland with a road or a foundation.
I guess the reason I'm asking these questions is because your table indicates that the Berkwin project had no permanent or temporary wetland impacts, and that's not what the commission ultimately found in its decision. So I'm wondering how you're coming to that conclusion with that table, and what your basis is for your opinion.
Sure. So I wasn't directly involved in the Burke project, but through preparation for this project, my understanding is after the hearing at Burke that we went back and redesigned our project to avoid all permanent impacts and direct impacts to wetlands on the Burke project before it was denied. So ultimately, had it been built, there would have been no direct or permanent impacts to wetlands.
Okay, so we're talking about permanent, we're talking about things that actually physically would impact the wetland itself in the line. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. But these wetlands do serve as a habitat for a variety of wildlife species. Is that correct?
Yes, I'd agree with that.
And specifically breeding waterfowl, right?
Correct.
Now, going back to that table on page 8 of your pre-filed testimony, you indicate that 486 breeding waterfowl will be displaced as a result of this project, and there were 981 breeding waterfowl that were anticipated to be displaced as a result of the Berkwin project. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
How did you come up with the estimate for this project, and did you use the same means and methods for doing so that were utilized for the Burke project?
Well, so to compare apples to apples, the method we used on Northern Divide, we also ran the same model on the Burke project. And that method is a method that the wildlife agencies, after the Burke project, they released a model called the Avian Impact Offset Model. And that is the model we use to develop these numbers.
So the numbers that I see in this table with respect to displacement of breeding waterfowl, those were taken from, those weren't internally created, they were taken from another source?
They were developed in coordination with the wildlife agencies. We both ran the model concurrently to determine if we were getting the same results.
So I guess, how confident are you that the proposed project layout will actually have a 51% decrease in breeding waterfowl displacement from the Burke project?
You know, it's based on model inputs. Unless we monitor every duck out there, we can only assume based on the model data, and working with the wildlife agencies, these are the numbers that we feel comfortable with in developing our offset plan, and that's how we developed it.
And are you comfortable that that's basically the best you can do to come up with the number, is the means and methods that you've utilized?
I'm sure there are extensive field studies that can be done, but what you try to do in these situations is develop some type of model or method to where you can estimate as best you can without spending multiple years studying thousands of ducks
So the word displacement's been, now it's in your table and I've used it a couple times too, but I guess I should probably clarify, what does the term displacement mean in this table and with respect to your testimony?
Sure, displacement is a term, it's an indirect effect. So we were talking about direct and indirect. Displacement would be an indirect effect of a turbine. So we may sight a turbine in an upland or in a tilled cropland, but a duck may move away. They've been displaced. So it just means that a duck moved. It doesn't say what happened to that duck. They could have gone over the hill to another wetland. They could have gone to another state. It just means they moved. We don't know what happened to the duck.
Does displacement include a number of projected fatalities?
It does not. It's not a projection of loss of species. It's just a projection that they moved.
Now, does the placement of a turbine adjacent to a wetland increase the probability of fatality due to collisions?
It could. I would recommend that question would probably go to Mr. Clayton Derby. He specializes in more of the wildlife risk assessments, and you know we rely on his information to help us in siting.
Okay. So any questions? As far as the methodology, going into wildlife fatalities and things like that should be directed towards Mr. Derby.
Yes, sir. And my understanding, you know, in speaking with Mr. Derby is we don't anticipate any risk different from other wind projects sited with in similarly situated landscapes in North Dakota and South Dakota and adjacent states like Minnesota that have, you know, numerous wetlands.
Now, during your direct testimony and in your pre-file testimony as well, you alluded to the fact that Northern Divide Wind has entered into this voluntary offset with game and fish for impacts to breeding waterfowl habitat. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So I guess my question is it safe to assume that this project will have some impact on breeding waterfowl?
I would say any development project has an impact to affect wildlife, and just like any other wind development in the U.S., there's potential to impact not just waterfowl but other avian species. But we don't feel the risk for this project is any different from others based on our coordination with our consultants that help us analyze that information.
Now, in the table, you indicate that Northern Divide Wind has committed to 196 acres of wetlands as an offset. Is that true?
Yes, so that is our current commitment.
So how do you pair that with your conclusion that this project will impact 0 acres of wetlands?
Because we're not impacting the wetland, we're impacting the species that use the wetland. The wetland will still be on the landscape functioning like a wetland does. You know, it will hold water. We won't replace the wetland with fill or dirt or equipment, you know, those types of things. It will still function as a wetland on the landscape. We're just impacting the wildlife that may use the wetland.
Do you believe there are any reasonable alternatives for siting this wind project so fewer impacts to wetlands will occur or no impacts to wetlands will occur?
I think it's very difficult to mitigate to zero, and that's not really the goal of the siting criteria. You're looking for minimal impact, and I think through our coordination with the wildlife agencies, we have found a site that meets that criteria. In further letters, we've effectively minimized our impact.
And so, maybe I should phrase that question a little differently, because I understand what you're saying by it's difficult to go down from zero, and you're talking about direct impacts there, but I'm more tailoring the question towards the company has engaged in an agreement to offset some habitat loss as a result of this project, or do you not agree with that?
I would disagree that we're not resulting in habitat loss. We're just displacing species that use that habitat. There's going to be no loss of wetland habitat.
Okay, so what is a habitat if species can't live there? I guess what's the definition of a habitat then?
There, other species could still use that. It doesn't mean all ducks leave that wetland. Other ducks can still use it. So the habitat still functions as it should, as it would under normal conditions. It's just some birds may move.
So you're talking about the impact on the animal, not the impact on the physical location. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, sir. And that's kind of the way the models were based off of studies that study the impact on the wildlife, not on the habitat itself.
So the 196 acres of wetlands that are being used as an offset, that's really just to account for the animals, or the birds, I guess, that would be potentially leaving the area based off of your models. Is that fair to say?
Yes, sir. And then that 196 acres of wetlands that will be offset will be available for ducks and other wildlife to use.
I want to go back to the table that you have on page 8 of your pre-filed testimony. And in that table, it indicates that 7% of the project area is located in unbroken grassland. Is that correct?
I would say the project area encompasses approximately 7% of unbroken grassland. I'd say that's correct.
And I should specify, this table just relates to the wind project, not the transmission line. Am I right on that?
That is correct, because the avian displacement models are specific to wind turbines and not the transmission lines.
One of the terms that was used quite a bit at the last hearing, and I've seen it pop up in this application too, is the term native prairie. And I'm curious, is there a difference between unbroken grassland and native prairie?
Sure. Mr. Schmidt, if I could direct you to, I believe it's, bear with me. It's in my pre-filed testimony.
I do think you addressed it in your pre-filed testimony. I'm just kind of looking for a quick general discussion from you on that. So we have something on the record.
I can. So native prairie is a type of unbroken grassland. But not all unbroken grassland is native prairie. And so unbroken grassland can be, you know, it's kind of based on soil integrity. Has it been tilled? Has there been extensive rock clearing that has broken the soil? And you can have unbroken grasslands with a lot of non-native invasive species, whereas a native prairie has a high quality composition of grassland and forb species that support a high diversity of grassland associated wildlife.
So do you know what percentage of the project area is actually native prairie?
No, sir. We didn't go to that level analysis. We just, within our construction easements in our survey areas, we just ensured that we avoided native prairie within unbroken grassland areas. So we have no impacts to native prairie.
Now, the table indicates that 0 acres of unbroken grassland will sustain a permanent impact, but it also indicates that 8 acres of unbroken grassland will have a temporary impact. And I guess I'm curious as to how you can have a temporary impact to unbroken grassland.
Sure. Similar to the way I described the temporary impacts to wetlands. For example, we're going to have a few locations where due to siting restrictions, we just could not avoid unbroken non-native prairie grasslands with our collection line. So we will be putting underground collection in unbroken grassland, but then restoring it to pre-impact conditions. So we'll follow topsoil removal procedures and make sure we restore that unbroken grassland to pre-impact conditions.
Now, I also note that in this table on page 8 of your pre-filed testimony, it indicates that 188 acres of unbroken grassland are located within 300 meters of a turbine, and this is a 75% reduction from the Burke Wind Project. My question is, what is significant about the 300-meter number?
That is a number that comes out of the studies. It's called the Schaefer et al. Study in 2019 when they released the avian offset impact model. That's the recommendation from the agencies to measure displacement of grassland birds within 300 meters of turbines. So that's why that's significant.
And I think that kind of maybe answers my next question, but we'll see. Because on your table, you also indicate that grassland bird displacement will be reduced by 75% from the Burke Wind Project. The question is, there a direct correlation between turbine placement within 300 meters of unbroken grassland and grassland bird displacement?
Based on the studies, that if you site a turbine within 300 meters, you could have a displacement effect on certain grassland species. I'd like to clarify, those studies only looked at 9 species. 7 of those species showed a displacement effect. 2 of them showed a positive effect. They were attracted to the area.
So in the table where it shows a 75% decrease between unbroken grassland within 300 meters of a turbine and a 75% decrease of grassland bird air estimated displacement, is that just a coincidence, or how do you get to that?
Can you repeat that question, sir?
Sure. If you look at the last two lines on the table on page 8 of your pre-filed testimony, yes, it shows a 75% decrease from the current wind project from the Burke Wind Project with respect to both the unbroken grassland within 300 meters of the turbines and the grassland bird pair estimated displacement count. Is that just a coincidence that they're the same percentage, or is there a direct correlation?
There's a direct correlation because the displacement of birds is based off the acreage. So you would assume that if you it's kind of apples for apples. If you displace 75% using the same model somewhere else, but you go somewhere with a less grassland acreage, you would also displace, the same percentage. It's based on a 53% displacement rate.
So I guess the next logical question is, if there were no turbines located within 300 meters of an unbroken grassland, would there be no expected displacement of grassland birds?
Based on the model input, that is an assumption.
I just wanted to make sure I was understanding the correlation correctly. Which grassland bird species do you anticipate being displaced as a result of the wind project?
There's no way to determine exactly what species they are. The study was based off 9. I don't have that study in front of me, but it could be numerous types of species. Maybe Mr. Derby has better information on that. He's very familiar with the study results or the study models.
Well, one of the next line of questions I have has to do with grouse leks. And is that something that you're going to be able to address, or should I direct those to Mr. Derby?
Let's see what the question is. Maybe I can address it, and then we can decide if Mr. Derby.
Okay, well, we'll start with an easy one then. What is a grouse lek?
So grouse lek are breeding grounds where male grouse species will gather to try to attract females.
And I know you, or at least Northern Divide Wind, put quite a bit of information about grouse leks into the application. And I'm looking at Appendix B5 of Exhibit 1. And there's if you look at, it's page 2 of Exhibit B5, there's a whole section in there on grouse leks. And this was something that was discussed quite at length at the Burke Wind hearing. But my question is, has the entire new project area been surveyed for grouse leks?
No, sir, it has not. So there's a if you look on figure 2 of that appendix, it kind of shows where the grouse lek surveys were done for the previous project. And you can see areas of purple that were not included in those studies. When we started the Northern Divide Wind Project, it was after the grouse lek survey season because when the project was denied. But we do have a strategy. We anticipate very low risk of any new additional leks because the areas we moved into are agricultural landscapes, which are not anticipated to, that's not habitat for grouse leks. Mr. Schmidt, I lost your video and your audio.
Your entire answer.
Brian Schmidt, your audio keeps cutting out.
Nothing.
I just want to check, is everyone else hear me okay? I just want to see if it's on my end or Mr. Schmidt's end. I see some nodding heads that you can hear me.
We can hear you, Mr. Jones. And I think that last thing you said, Mr. Schmidt, I think that was coming through if you want to try again. Okay. Nope, we can't hear you.
Okay, am I back?
Yes. Nope, we can't hear you again.
Are we good to go? Okay. Can you see me?
Yes. I think there's actually a delay going on, but go ahead.
Okay, we'll try it. I understand that Northern Divide Wind applied a 0.5-mile setback around all LECs identified in the previous study for the Berkwind project. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And it appears that there's at least a portion of the new project area that hasn't yet been studied for the presence of grouse lecs, based off of what I think you answered my previous question with.
Yes, sir, there is a portion.
So my question is, how is Northern Divide going to account for any grouse lecs that are found once the new project area is studied?
Sure. So it's standard practice for most of our projects. We always go out pre-construction surveys for any nest or lecs that could have occurred after our last round of surveys. So if we identify any of those lecs, we will set up construction limitations to where we at least during construction will stay a half mile away so that there's no impact to the lec during the lecking season.
Do lecs change over time?
I'm not a grouse expert, but my understanding, and Mr. Derby can probably expand on it, but my understanding is some lecs may be used once and never used again. Some may be used multiple times, and you know, a lec can show up one year and not there the next. But that's my understanding of grouse lecs. He could definitely expand a lot further than I could.
Do you know if there's been any studies performed to assess the risk to grouse in the presence of a wind turbine? Or is that something I should maybe ask Mr. Derby about?
I'm aware of studies, but I couldn't speak to the results of those studies. That is definitely a Mr. Derby question.
I want to talk about eagles a little bit, and I understand that the studies that were performed in the project area indicate that there is a history of bald eagles being present in the project area. Is that correct?
There was recorded use of eagles, but no eagle nest.
Do you know how long the survey period was for the evaluation of the presence of eagles?
We typically do a year pre-construction avian use studies. And I think those were done, and Mr. Derby can probably confirm, those were done both in 2017 and some in 2018.
Were they done in preparation for the Berk project?
Yes.
Okay. So have any studies been done that encompass the entire project area that we're looking at with this application?
Well, we are doing nest surveys now for eagles, but no eagle use surveys are being done.
What happens if you find a bald eagle nest while you're doing these surveys? How would that impact the project layout?
Again, we think that risk is pretty low based on our Mr. Derby's and his team's assessment of risk and their review of all the existing reports. But if a nest does appear in a project area during construction, we do have protocols to where we at least avoid that nest by a half mile during construction until that nest is no longer active.
Do you know if there have been any studies that have been conducted to assess the risk to bald eagles from a wind turbine?
Yes, sir. I'm aware that there have been studies, but again, the level of detail of those studies is a Mr. Derby question.
And are golden eagles going to be handled essentially the same way the bald eagles are going to be handled with respect to finding nests and avoidance and those type of measures?
Yes, sir.
Do you anticipate there being any, increased risk to the bald or golden eagle as a result of the construction of this project?
It's my understanding through our analysis that West conducted that adverse impacts to bald and golden eagles are not anticipated.
Let's shift gears and talk about whooping cranes for a little bit. Now, I understand this is an endangered species, correct?
It is on the federal endangered species list, yes.
And the project area and the transmission line area are located within the whooping crane corridor, correct?
That is correct.
Can I have you turn to, it would be Appendix B7?
Is this of Exhibit 1?
Of Exhibit 1. And flip to page number 2. And not Roman numeral 2, but numerical value 2. Should see a map with a whole bunch of colors on it.
Did you say, oh, I'm sorry. So there's multiple, let's see, I see B7. Let me see here. Oh, sorry, I was on the wrong B7. I was on B7-6. Just a second. Thank you, I'm on that map.
Okay. Sure, you're on the map that has the whooping crane migratory corridor identified on it?
Yes, labeled as figure 1.
Yep. Can you just explain what this map says? There's just a lot going on with it. I want to have an understanding from the company's point of view as to how we're supposed to interpret this map.
Yes, sir. Again, I'll do my best on the understanding that I have of this map. And then if there's any follow-up questions, Mr. Derby can answer those. But, you see some dotted lines on the map that kind of run south to the northwest. That's the whooping crane corridor. And then the multiple shades of orange and purple and green and those, that is what's considered potential whooping crane use. And this data is based off of, I believe it's based off of telemetry data that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies have monitoring marked whooping cranes. And so the more orange it is, the higher use it is. So you can see there's a lot of high use from South Dakota up through North Dakota. Now this map only shows those two states, but this extends all the way down to the Gulf Coast of Texas and up into Canada.
And so this project, at least looking at this map, appears to be located pretty much right in the middle of the corridor. Is that accurate?
It is an accurate statement.
Okay. Looking at the application, it appears that to date, at least, there have been no recorded fatalities due to collisions with wind turbines for the whooping crane. Is that still an accurate statement?
That is my understanding. Mr. Derby and his company have done extensive studies on whooping cranes, but understand within the whooping crane corridor, there's been no reported deaths of whooping cranes.
And the same cannot be said for transmission lines. Is that fair to say?
I believe that is fair to say. I think there has been some recorded more fatalities of whooping cranes with transmission lines. But again, Clayton can confirm when he testifies as well.
I'm curious about what mitigative measures Northern Divide Wind is going to take to at least try to mitigate the problems that we may have with whooping cranes flying into the transmission line. And I know there's some talk about avian flight diverters, but I would like you to expand on that a little bit more.
Sure. That's an avian power line interaction committee recommendation. So when you're in areas of potential high risk of collision, they do recommend you mark your transmission line with what's called avian flight diverters or bird flight diverters. It makes the transmission line very visible to the species, not just whooping cranes, but any avian species that use the area to minimize, you know, risk to whooping cranes or other birds.
Has that, I guess, mitigation system been found to be effective?
I believe so. I think APLIC has studies that they reference, and that's why they make those recommendations. And again, these are recommendations that, you know, the agencies have been aware of our studies and our reports since December. And I think we've addressed that effectively. So.
Now, I know North Dakota Game and Fish indicated some concern with respect to this project's impact on the Sprague's pipit, and primarily their concern related to the location of the transmission line. My first question is, what is a Sprague's pipit?
I think it's just a small grassland bird, but I would have to ask Clayton. I'm not an ornithologist. So.
That's fine, but I guess the description of the bird probably isn't overly important, whether the steps that are being taken mitigate risk to it or not. But Game and Fish indicated that the location of the proposed transmission line overlaps with one of the few places in North Dakota where a high concentration of the pipit still exists. Do you have any reason to disagree with Game and Fish's assessment there?
I have no reason to disagree. And I think you're referring to the agency's North Dakota Game and Fish's September 2019 letter. And then in October, we did respond to that letter addressing their concerns. And when in the subsequent letters from Game and Fish, they no longer brought up concerns with the pipit. So I think we've effectively minimize those impacts.
And other than the written correspondence that you had with Game and Fish that I know is part of the record, were there any other conversations that either you or one of your colleagues had with Game and Fish about the issues that were raised in the initial letter?
Sure. And, you know, when that letter was filed, this was before I think the agency fully realized all the commitments we were going to make. And then shortly thereafter, we had numerous meetings, conversations, coordination with modeling to meet those needs.
Do you recall if anything specific was done with respect to this project layout between the time that Game and Fish sent their initial letter indicating there was concern about Sprague pipit and now?
Can you reframe or restate your question?
Sure. From the time that Game and Fish was initially made aware of where this transmission line was going to be, has Northern Divide taken any steps to change the layout or mitigate the potential impacts to the Sprague's pipit?
Not specifically to that species. A lot of our mitigation measures we're trying to avoid placing structures in grasslands. We're marking the transmission line, again, to make it visible to the species to reduce any potential impact.
Want to move on to the Dakota Skipper for a little bit. It's my understanding that the Dakota Skipper is a threatened species of butterfly. Is that your understanding as well?
That is my understanding.
What does it mean to be a threatened species?
Let me clarify. I think it's considered an endangered species, the endangered Dakota Skipper butterfly.
Okay, so endangered as opposed to threatened. Is there a meaningful difference to you as far as protecting the habitat between those two terms?
We treat them similarly. You know, if there's potential skipper habitat, we try to avoid, whether they're threatened or endangered.
And there is suitable Dakota skipper habitat within the project area for both the wind project and the transmission line, correct?
Yes, sir. Our consultants and our Dakota skipper specialists did map potentially suitable habitat.
And in the application for the wind project, and I'm referencing Exhibit 1 and page 5-27, but it indicates the primary cause for decline in Dakota skipper populations includes the loss of fragmentation of high-quality native prairie habitat. Does that comport with your understanding of the loss of Dakota skipper population?
That comports with my understanding. You know, I understand, you know, lots of different development and land conversion activities have resulted in the decline of the species.
What is the habitat for a Dakota skipper? Like what makes up that habitat?
I'll address it as best as I can. Again, I'm not a Dakota skipper specialist, but I understand it. It's based on the type of vegetation that grows in certain what's considered high quality native prairies. It's called native prairie obligates. Basically, these species kind of only occur in those areas and they're attractants for the butterfly. So that's probably, you know, there are probably some indicator species of specific types of vegetation that considers an area suitable.
And it's my understanding from reading the application that suitable habitats within the project area will be fenced off to prevent disturbance.
Well, I lost you again, Mr. Schmidt. I don't know if anybody else did.
Okay, you cut out on me too. Do you got me now?
Oh, yeah, everybody just went away and came back, so I think we're good. So I got you now.
I had the same thing happen. Suitable habitats for the Dakota skipper are going to be fenced off to prevent disturbance during construction in the wind project. Is that correct?
In both the wind and transmission project.
Can I have you turn to, if you can find exhibit number 2, which is the transmission line application, and turn to appendix B3.
I'm in exhibit 2 of 63.
Habitat evaluation.
Yes, sir.
And then there's some maps in this appendix. It's actually appendix A of appendix B3.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Could I have you turn to the map on page 4 of 10?
Okay.
And at the bottom of that map, there is a pole that's labeled 020. Do you see where that is?
Yes, sir.
And it appears to be located directly adjacent to what's been deemed a suitable Dakota skipper habitat. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I think the scale of the map, you know, those are big dots when you consider we're going to have a very small transmission pole there. So there is a definite setback from that. It's just at this scale, you can't really, you know, there's some overlap from the symbology from the map, but there's no overlap with the structure into the Dakota skipper. But it is close to the habitat.
Okay. Well, let's see if that might answer a variety of my other questions here then too. Because if we go to the map on page 10 of 10, I believe it is. Yeah, okay. 10 of 10. And we look at, for example, pole 214. Excuse me, that's map 9 of 10.
Okay, thank you. 214, yes, sir.
And that appears that the circle is almost completely inside of the Dakota skipper habitat. I guess is that just a scaling issue with respect to the map?
It is a scaling issue. Again, construction will be taking place very near that, but there is no infrastructure in that grassland, and there will be strict construction requirements anytime you're near these areas.
So it is Northern Divide Wind's, I guess, plan to not place any structure, whether it be a wind turbine or a transmission line pole, in a Dakota skipper habitat. Is that accurate?
I would say that's accurate for all of our infrastructure, including temporary access. We will avoid it at all.
Do you know if there are any studies that have been shown or any studies conducted that show an adverse impact to the Dakota skipper by placing a transmission line pole right next to its habitat?
I am not aware of any studies like that. We do have our Dakota Skipper specialist available if that is of interest to you, and we can make him available and to call in, but I'm not aware of it.
Okay. One thing I did note when going through this application, the documents that were submitted, is there was a lot of correspondence with North Dakota Game and Fish, but we don't have any letters back from United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And I'm curious as to whether Northern Divide Wind contacted U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with respect to this project.
Yes, sir. So when we refer to the wildlife agencies, we're referring to both organizations. They have been engaged the entire time. Every correspondence we had with Game and Fish, they were copied on. They were part of the modeling exercise. It's my understanding is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service asked North Dakota Game and Fish just to take the lead on this, and that any comments they had were drafted concurrently with their, you know, and when Game and Fish would file a letter, they would copy U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That's my understanding.
Are you aware of any conversations that Northern Divide Wind had directly with U.S. Fish and Wildlife where Game and Fish wasn't involved?
No, because it was kind of a joint effort. Every time we got on the phone, we wanted to make sure all players were involved and all stakeholders.
Okay. Let's shift gears to the sound studies for a little bit. I know you addressed that in your pre-filed testimony. And I know that we have some criteria as far as sound goes, but my question is, how do you conduct a sound study for a wind farm that doesn't exist yet?
Sure, you know, this is kind of getting out of my level of expertise, but everything is based on model inputs. You know, things that are very important to that model are the location of the proposed turbine. Then the turbine manufacturer produces what's called noise emission specification sheets. That information gets input into the model. And then we also, you know, do surveys for all potential receptors within 2 miles of those turbines. And those get input into the model to determine the impact on that potential receptor. So.
And how do you determine where you're going to put these receptors?
Oh, the receptors are the home, the community buildings, or the occupied dwellings. That's what we consider a receptor. It could be an occupied residence or a community building. And that's what we're modeling for.
Okay. That's my understanding that these models are essentially conducted in a hypothetical world where there's not a lot of, I guess, natural disturbances on top of that, on top of what's in the model. It's just kind of a vacuum type of a model.
It is, but we do input certain, you know, terrain and elevation data is included. We include, you know, for example, for shadow flicker models, we assume that there's no like tree cover that could you know, dampen the sound. So sometimes our models are overly conservative.
Is this project expected to generate noticeable noise to any occupied residences?
You know, based on our studies, it will be in compliance with the commission's criteria and the county's more restrictive criteria. So no, we don't anticipate that there would be, you know, when you say noticeable noise, I guess it depends on the conditions, but we anticipate minimal impact.
I use the word noticeable kind of intentionally, because I think the number that you said was it 48 decibels was the highest at any receptor. What is 48 decibels? What can you compare that to?
I would have to follow up with our shadow flicker expert and get that answer to you. I don't, that's outside my kind of world of expertise, really.
Sure. And I know you did address shadow flicker. I just have one or two quick questions about it. The studies that you have in the application indicate that the maximum shadow flicker that the models projected for, I guess, any of the occupied residences was 22 hours per year. Is that correct? So am I correct in assuming that that means over the course of a 365-day span, The total amount of shadow flicker that that residence would receive is 22 hours.
That's my understanding. There could be days, it could be just a few minutes of shadow flicker, and then days it could be a little longer. So that's the cumulative total over the span of a year.
So one day there could be 3 minutes, another day there could be 15 minutes, another day there could be zero, but when you add all those days up, it's going to equal 22 hours?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I want to touch on just a little bit of the agency correspondence that's in this case. The North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality issued a letter that had a variety of recommendations in it, and it's in Exhibit 1, Appendix C, and then Section C.
Bear with me while I get there. Okay, I'm at attachment C4.
Yep, and you should be looking at a September 4th, 2019 letter from the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality.
I am.
Okay, so there's a variety of comments that they have issued, and then I guess 2 pages after that, there's a construction and environmental disturbance requirement page.
Yes, sir.
My question is, does Northern Divide Wind agree to follow the recommendations of the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality?
Yes, sir. These are letters we commonly get on our construction projects in North Dakota. You know, and our construction team is well aware of the commitment, and we successfully follow these mitigation requirements on many of our projects.
Since we're already in Appendix C, can I have you find Section C7? And it's a letter dated August 30th, 2019 from the North Dakota Geological Survey.
Yes, sir.
This letter, I'm looking at the second full paragraph. First sentence, it says, based on the extent of the proposed project areas, it appears there are some locations in the southern portion of the transmission line corridor boundaries that contain areas mapped as landslides or features that suggest slope instability. Do you see that?
Hey.
If we look at the transmission line application, which is exhibit number 2, and if you turn to page 3-2, of that application, and about halfway down, it has a line that says areas which are geologically unstable, and
yes,
it states not applicable. So I guess my question is, how do you pair the letter from the North Dakota Geological Survey with the statement in Exhibit 2?
Yes, sir, that's a great question. So we were aware of the comments from the Geological Survey, but we conduct a pretty extensive geotechnical analysis that evaluates soil, and we don't place infrastructure in any areas that are deemed unstable or unsuitable. So that's one reason we've been able to avoid any of those unstable areas.
So is it your testimony that the transmission line is not going to be located in any areas of geologic instability?
It may span some, but we're not placing any infrastructure in those areas.
I have one last question. I asked Mr. Cameron about this earlier.
Yes.
And I know that part of the agreement that Northern Divide reached with Game and Fish was that no expansion of this project will occur, and there'll be no other projects in the Northern Missouri Coteau. Is that correct?
That is a commitment the company has made, correct.
So I guess my question is, why is it okay to put this project there, but it's not okay to put any more there?
Well, whether or not it's okay to put another one here, that could, another project developer could come in here, another company, and choose the site. know, there are many areas in the Missouri Coteau that are, like I said, have been disturbed by agriculture in those areas, so they it may be suitable. But it was a commitment based off our response to addressing the agency's concerns about the Missouri Coteau. And the one reason it's still suitable to keep this project there is through our coordination with the agencies. We had a, you know, we had a customer that was still wanting this project. We had landowners that really were willing to host this project. So we were able to find a path forward to maintain this project in the area that it is with the wildlife agencies to meet not just our needs, but the needs of our customers and the landowners.
Mr. Jones, I believe that concludes my questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Pranis, do you have any questions for Mr. Jones?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak, do you have any questions for Mr. Jones?
I do, just a couple, though. On the sound study, and I'm looking at two figures. Let's see here. One was in the regular application, and I think, hold on. Oh, shoot. I thought there was a little bit of a discrepancy. Oh, here we go. Hold on. I'm going to get strong after this, lifting all these heavy binders.
Yes, ma'am, you do.
So in the application under acoustic assessment B as in boy 3, kind of table 3, there is a, the table, it says that there's an non-participating landowner that has a sound level of 47 dBA. Yeah, predicted. And then in the other binder where you talk, let's see, this is the supplemental information under tab E, where it shows the maps and stuff. I'm looking at this map that if you look on the screen, you can see it's figure 1. And it lists all the houses, all the receptors, and whether they're participating, non-participating, et cetera. I was just trying to find out where that number, where that non-participating residence with the 47 dBA is, and I cannot find them on this map.
Sure, I'll walk you through that. So the original application, that particular receptor is called receiver ID R30. At the time of the application, he was that landowner was a non-participant. In the supplement, if you'll read on in table 1 of the supplement, R30 is now a participating landowner. So that's probably why it doesn't match up for on the colors. And just to guide you to where that location is, it's about the center of the map. You'll see a yellow box that says 47 for turbine 47.
Yep.
If you go down to the circle, that is, I'm sorry, if you go north, there's kind of a purple participating parcel. That was the original 47 for when it was a non-participant, but that landowner is now a participant.
Okay, very good. I'm glad to see that there aren't any receptors, any pink non-participating receptors in the middle of the project boundary in some of those areas that were choosing not to be participants. Okay, just a couple other quick questions, because Brian did a great job going through everything real thoroughly. In the Eagle report, there's a map that shows them listed as incidental and then standardized. Can you tell me what's the difference between an incidental sighting and a standardized sighting?
Yeah, so a standardized sighting is where we have predefined points where we go and do our st- standard survey where we start the clock and we're looking for birds. An incidental is where we're driving it between points and we just may see an eagle flying over, incidental to our official survey. So we record the minutes that birds fly over through our standardized approach, but as we're driving to our next point to continue the survey protocol, we may incidentally see it. So we also like to log those too. Just it's additional information that goes into potential avian use.
Okay. Then in terms of the whooping cranes, there's been some sighted flying through, not stopping. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yet they feel that they fly higher than the turbines. And go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was done. Just do they feel that they fly higher than the turbine blades when it's fully extended?
If you're referring to the observation that our surveyors had, it was observed flying what they believe above what would be the normal rotor swept height. And in general, during migration, these birds do fly well above turbine height. Now, if they were to come down and land somewhere, they got to fly through, that elevation. But in general, during migration, they fly much higher than most turbine height.
Okay. And then in the survey of the habitat for stopovers, I would assume, for the whooping cranes, there was a average rating of 12 for the habitat in this area that I was looking at in the study. Can you give me the context? 12 out of what? Like, what would be like the perfect, most attractive, like the Ritz-Carlton of stopovers for the whooping cranes?
Commissioner, I may understand the question, but I think that might be best addressed by Mr. Derby, who conducted those surveys.
Sure.
I don't want to butcher it. So.
Sure. We'll wait for him. Okay. And then I just want to kind of conclude. I wanted to cite the final letter from North Dakota Game and Fish. So one of the biggest reasons driving the denial of the permit last time on Burke was the impact, the wetlands, and the impact to the habitat. And we quoted, consistently multiple times letters from the North Dakota Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but in particular North Dakota Game and Fish, saying that you couldn't have picked a worse location in North Dakota for a wind farm. And so I contrast that with the final letter that they said, and in it they list the different things that you guys have already highlighted, in the reduction of the size and the spacing of the turbines away from the wetlands and the location of the turbines entirely in cropland, not native prairie, and some of those as the most significant changes that have addressed their biggest issues. And their final statement is, we appreciate Northern Divide Wind's efforts to address the department's concerns. These efforts demonstrate their commitment to pursue wind development in a more responsible manner on this project and in the future. So Game and Fish doesn't give a thumbs up or down on projects. They give statements categorizing how they generally feel about things and leave it to us to kind of ultimately decide whether the impacts reach the level for a permit or not. And so, but this is a stark contrast to what they were saying the time before. And I think it does recognize the significant changes that you guys have made to this project. So in my mind, it does provide a very different view of the biological impacts that this project has from the agencies that we count on for reviewing that and providing that advice and analysis to us, because we don't have biologists on staff that do that review. We count on these expert agencies. So I just want to make note of that for the record, and for anybody listening, I would urge you to look at the back and forth between the company and the Game and Fish, all of which is categorized in the application and through the materials that have been provided. And you can see how what has been done to minimize those impacts that previously had a huge played a huge role in our last decision on this project. So with that, I don't have any other questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Crotchis, do you have any questions?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few. Are the offsets that you describe, are they within the project footprint, or are they outside of the project footprint?
They will be outside the project footprint. The wildlife agencies have asked that no offsets be placed within 800 meters of the turbines. So that will force us into looking into areas outside project.
Okay, can you help me out with if grasslands aren't replaceable, is generally what we hear, at least I hear, how do you reconstruct native prairie if, in effect, my understanding is it really can't be replaced?
So yeah, the commission has pretty restrictive policy on topsoil removal and segregation. So we will make sure that when we put that soil back, that it goes back not mixed up. That we will do our best to restore that grassland to the pre-impact condition to the best of our ability, and following seeding protocols and those types of things I forget the agency off the top of my head, but they have particular recommendations for how to reseed those areas and restore those areas.
Do you have an effectiveness rate you would be willing to state? Is it 80% of what it was before, 90%, less?
No, sir, I'm not a restoration specialist. We will be using third-party companies that do a lot of this work, and I'm sure they, you may not get back to what it was exactly before, but they can get really close to where it's going to be suitable habitat for the grassland-associated species that use it.
Are you aware of any landowners, participating landowners in the project who, in an effort to avoid the grassland issue, just went and tilled an acre where a turbine might be located?
No, sir. That is not a message that we want our landowners to hear. They understand there are many considerations we take in siting a project, be it environmental setbacks from roads and section lines and those types of things. And they understand there are restrictions that we have to comply with and that we have to meet a minimum standard. And we try not to get that message to any of our landowners, because we don't want that to happen.
The turbines, then, they will be located, I'm assuming, on tillable land or at least hay land instead of on grasslands. Is that essentially what happens when they're moved?
Are you speaking about the turbines, sir? I didn't quite hear the question very well. You were kind of cutting in.
Yes. The turbines that I think it's stated in the application, no turbines are situated on grasslands.
That's correct.
So, in effect,
they're all on field crop land, all the turbines.
Do you work with the landowners?
No, sir. That is not really my role. We have land agents that do that.
Just a couple more quick questions. Is the agreement to limit development in the Northern Coteau, future development, is that between Northern Divide and with Game and Fish, or is that with NextEra and Game and Fish, or do you consider that one and the same?
That is a commitment from NextEra, so not even another subsidiary of NextEra will develop in the Northern Missouri Plateau.
Okay. Here's the one question that, so it's been shifted to the west, the footprint, project footprint, but I'm not an expert in that region, but how do you counter the argument that it's really no different in terms of the type of terrain?
It really comes down to what our study results show and the land use and the land cover. The original project did have more, not just unbroken grassland, but other types of, broken grassland. And we're in an area that's really dominated by agriculture. And it is drastically different from the original project, even though there's large overlap, because a large part of the original Burke project was also in kind of disturbed habitat or disturbed landscape.
And this might have been a question for Mr. Cameron, but I'll throw it at you anyway. And that is, would you say the bulk of the mitigation, the decreases in terms of impacting the different wetland features, grasslands, et cetera, is really driven by just reducing project footprint?
I didn't hear the last part of that.
Is it being driven primarily by reducing the project footprint?
No, it's just reducing the project footprint. There's a lot of factors that relate in that. We have smaller parcels that we're on, but avoiding grasslands and wetlands isn't really affected by the project footprint size. We were just able to site turbines in a smaller project area than some other projects.
Okay, the reason I ask, when you look at the project area, the acres, a 52% decrease, and then when I'm looking at the different statistics, many parallel or essentially are in the same range as that percent decrease, within 5, 10, even 15%. So that's to me, it seems like the bulk of it's just driven by reducing land mass.
Yeah, so a lot of our landowners have smaller section sizes. They may not own an entire section, they own a quarter section. So if they were to own an entire section, it would have made our project bigger, because if we sign them up, we sign up the entire section or that entire parcel as part of our project area. We don't subdivide someone's project with our property boundaries. So in this instance, it just numerous factors kind of played into that, and that's one of them. We also had fewer receptors in the area or homes to set back from. So that allows you to place turbines in more locations. You have less areas to avoid there. So that's a benefit.
Okay. All right. No other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a little bit. Mr. Schmidt was so efficient. There's not much left, but I have the same question as Commissioner Fedorchuk on receptor R30 with the noise, but I want to drill down to just a couple others. And so my first question for Mr. Jones is, are you aware of the rule change that's proposed that haven't been finalized and published yet, but lowering the commission standards for noise from 50 decibels to 45?
I am aware of that proposed rulemaking, sir.
So in looking at the same sheet where Commissioner Fedorchuk left off in the original application in B3, Table 3, I want to talk then about receptors R10 and R17, also non-participants.
Okay, I'm on that table. I'm looking at okay. R17.
And R10.
R10, yes, sir.
Okay, and now I'm going to jump to, just keep those in mind, but I'm going to jump to a different table in the supplemental filing that was made later. And so yes. Now I'm in tab E, as in environment, table 2 and 3.
Table 2 and 3, yes, sir.
What's the difference between those two tables? If they were the other way around and had the same number, I'd assume that the page was just too short to get them all on there, but what's the difference?
So the table 2 is for landowners that had particular, they're participating landowners, they just had particular parcels that they did not want to lease into the project. So they are a participant, they just have parcels of land that they just didn't want to include in a participation agreement or in a lease agreement.
That's table also. 2?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And table 3 is solely landowners that didn't want any property or parcels participating in the land in the wind project.
Okay, so R17 is actually a participant in the project.
Yes, sir. That's
not just a residence.
Yeah, a small parcel they didn't want to sign up.
Okay. And R10 is on the other page because they not only did not sign up the land upon which their residence is, they didn't sign into anything.
That's correct.
If things don't get done on time and that rule becomes in effect before then, how do you think that would impact this turbine 45? I'm not sure what the turbine number is, but the one that impacts resident R10.
Well, I understand the proposed rulemaking would be 45 dBA or less. So I think we would meet that standard because we're at 45 or less.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying the difference between these two tables. I have no other questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Fury, did you have any redirect?
Yes, Your Honor, just a few questions. Mr. Jones, just want to circle back to the Eagle surveys that were conducted for the project. Can you please describe the area that the Eagle surveys cover?
Sure, so the Eagle surveys cover the project. Eagle Nest surveys or avian use surveys?
The Eagle Nest surveys.
Eagle Nest surveys. They cover the project area plus a 10-mile buffer. So the original Burke project, that 10-mile buffer easily encompasses the Northern Divide Wind Project.
Okay, thank you. And then with respect to the Frigg Pipit, if you could please turn to the North Dakota Game and Fish letter dated September 12, 2019. This is located in Appendix B6 of Exhibit 1, which is the wind project application.
Almost there. Yes, I'm there.
Great. Mr. Schmidt had identified some comments that were contained within this letter regarding PIPIT. And he had questions whether there was anything additional that was done with respect to PIPIT subsequent to this letter. And was it your prior testimony that the North Dakota Game and Fish had issued this letter before kind of fully understanding the full scope of mitigation measures that you had proposed with respect to the revised project?
Yes, that's my understanding. We were still negotiating with Game and Fish throughout the summer, but, you know, they issued this letter, and then shortly thereafter is when we really got into the weeds and all the details of the offset, the mitigation, and moving. And so this was prior to that information.
Great. Can I please have you turn to the letter that's directly behind this letter? It's dated October 1st, 2019.
I'm there.
Okay. Can I please have you turn to the second page of that letter?
Yes, page two.
Yes. And so I'm looking at this section of this letter, and it's titled paragraph 4.5. And there's two paragraphs. And I see that the Spriggs pipit is addressed in the second paragraph. Can you please read that second paragraph?
Sure. In regard to Spriggs pipit, the project is currently sited in an area dominated by tilled cropland, and no permanent above-ground wind facility infrastructure is sited in unbroken grasslands, avoiding further fragmentation that may negatively impact the species. The project transmission line is also sited mostly in tilled cropland, but it is also co-located to existing roads where possible, located in areas fragmented by private roads and petrochemical infrastructure, or in grasslands with a high tree and shrub densities, all of which are unsuitable habitat for the species.
And this October 1st letter was a follow-up to that prior letter that we just referenced, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then with respect to Dakota Skipper suitable habitats, there was prior discussion about areas that were located adjacent to various transmission line structures, correct? And you had testified that these areas would be flagged or marked off with fencing to avoid disturbance, correct?
Correct.
And so besides the fencing, is there any communication that will occur with the boots on the ground so that they're informed and aware that these are sensitive areas that should be avoided?
Sure. So we've outlined a lot of commitments in our mitigation measures. And when we go from development to the construction phase, we have what's called an execution to construction. And that's where the pre-construction environmental commitments that we make get memorialized in a matrix that gets handed off to an environmental compliance team that oversees the consultants that ensure the contractors comply with all of those commitments. So they will be boots on the ground folks, making sure the fencing stays installed, that equipment doesn't go in there, those types of things. That's how we make sure that we meet these commitments. And additionally, we provide constraint maps of all of these areas so they are aware. And during the plan of the day meetings, they identify where they're going to be working that day. And then there's discussions of where there's constraints to be aware of. So there's constant communication between the on-the-ground construction folks and our environmental compliance team.
Thank you. I have no additional questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Schmidt, did you have any other questions?
I just have one quick line of follow-up based on the implementation of mitigation measures. It has to do with the whooping crane. I understand from the application that if there's a whooping crane sighting after the project becomes operational, that the turbines will be shut down for a period of time until the whooping crane leaves, and then 15 minutes after the whooping crane leaves. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's part of our whooping crane curtailment procedure.
So can that be detected and implemented through the remote monitoring of the project area?
No. If you're talking about from our operations facilities in Florida?
Yeah, because my question is, how are you going to know if there's a whooping crane in the project area unless either one, you can detect it from the remote location, or two, you just have someone out there standing in the middle of the project area staring at the sky looking for a whooping crane 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So how do you implement that?
We implement that through, we have an on-site O&M staff that are doing routine maintenance, inspections of the facility. We have other subcontractors. Anybody that comes through the project area that is working is trained on how to identify a whooping crane, and that gets reported back to the O&M or to the site manager to make sure we can implement that procedure. Even if a landowner was to call our O&M and said, I think I see whooping cranes near your project, we will send somebody out to confirm that, and if that is an accurate statement, they haven't misidentified another big white bird, we will curtail at that time too. So I'm acting a little surprised because I lost everybody's cameras.
I can still hear you, but I can't see you.
We can continue.
Okay. So I guess just to kind of bring this all together, the only way that Northern Divide Wind has of identifying a whooping crane in the project area is by someone physically seeing it from the site. It's not something that can be done remotely.
That's correct.
I think that's all my questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Lean, I think I missed you on the first round of questioning. Did you have any questions for Mr. Jones?
No questions. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Are there any additional questions from the commissioners? All right. I'm seeing shaking heads no. So thank you. All right. Mr. Jones, it looks like that's all the questions for you today.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you, commissioners.
We're going to take a 10-minute break. Actually, we'll make it 8 minutes, and we'll reconvene at 2:50. All right, I think we have everybody back, so we will get started again. Ms. Fury, did you want to call your next witness?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. At this time, I call Mr. Clayton Derby.
All right, good afternoon, Mr. Derby. Before you testify this afternoon, I'm required by law to advise you on the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
Yes.
In being advised on the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Fury.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Derby, can you please introduce yourself to the commission?
Yes, hello. My name is Clayton Derby, Chief Services Officer and Senior Wildlife Biologist for Western Ecosystems Technology, or WEST. I was retained by Northern Divide Wind to provide wildlife-related advice and assistance on Northern Divide Wind's projects.
And can you please briefly describe your educational and professional background?
I received a bachelor's degree in biology from Morehead State University and a master's degree in zoology and physiology from the University of Wyoming. I've worked for WEST as a wildlife consultant and involved in wind wildlife-related projects for 25 years. I've been involved in evaluating environmental and wildlife impacts for approximately 35 wind projects in North Dakota and hundreds across the United States.
And are you familiar with the project's applications and supporting filings related to wildlife and native habitats?
Yes, I've reviewed all the wildlife and native habitat technical reports for the projects and pertinent portions of the project's applications.
Did you submit pre-filed testimony to the commission?
Yes, my pre-filed testimony was submitted to the commission on April 1st.
And do you have a copy of Exhibit 8 before you?
Yes.
Is Exhibit 8 a correct copy of your April 1st pre-filed testimony?
Yes, it is.
And is this exhibit a true and accurate representation of what your testimony would be if you were to give your testimony orally to the commission?
It is.
Can you please provide additional detail regarding your role in the Northern Divide project?
I've been advising Northern Divide Wind on wildlife and habitat studies, managing wildlife studies, assisting with coordination with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and North Dakota Game and Fish Department, in drafting Northern Divide Wind's Wildlife Conservation Strategy, or WCS. The WCS is used to help Northern Divide Wind fully evaluate risk to wildlife, document potential impacts through avoidance and minimization efforts, establish post-construction efforts, and outline agreed upon offsetting measures or mitigation.
And will the wind project have an adverse impact on grasslands, grassland nesting birds, wetlands, or waterfowl?
No. There are no wind turbines sited in unbroken grasslands, and there are no impacts to wetlands. I expect the wind project to have a minimal adverse effect on grassland nesting birds. Northern Divide Wind has made significant efforts to reduce the wind project size, move the wind project further away from Lostwood National Wildlife Refuge, inside the wind project in an area dominated by tilled agriculture, previously broken grass, and previously broken grasslands, thus minimizing adverse effects to grassland nesting birds and their habitat. Similarly, I expect the wind project to have minimal adverse effects on waterfowl. Mortality of waterfowl is expected to be similarly low as other wind projects within North Dakota and other locations. Based upon recommendations from the wildlife agencies, the Schaefer et al. Model was used to estimate displacement of breeding waterfowl and grassland birds from turbines. This displacement could result in approximately 486 pairs of ducks being displaced and 339 to 116 pairs of grassland nesting birds being displaced. But as described in my written testimony, it is possible that these birds will simply move to another wetland or grassland and successfully breed. To offset this potential displacement, however, of breeding waterfowl and grassland nesting birds, Northern Divide Wind has committed to recreate and restore 196 wetland acres and 100 acres of grassland. In combination, these efforts have addressed impacts to waterfowl and grassland nesting birds.
Will the projects have adverse effects on critical habitat or threatened or endangered species?
No, there's no critical habitat within either of the projects, and that no adverse impacts to critical habitat will occur. As described in Mr. Jones' written testimony, most threatened and endangered species as identified in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Information for Planning and Conservation, or IPAC tool, do not have potential habitat within or near the projects, and thus would have no adverse effects. This includes least tern, pallid sturgeon, northern long-eared bat, piping plover, and roof of red knot. Additional analysis was conducted for Dakota skipper and whooping crane. While the wind project is within the overall whooping crane migration corridor, potential habitat exists within the wind project, similar to numerous other projects in North and South Dakota. The scientific research has not documented whooping crane or sandhill crane mortality at wind projects in the migratory corridor. Impacts to whooping cranes are not anticipated. To further mitigate potential risk, Northern Divide Wind will develop and implement a voluntary whooping crane identification, training, and curtailment procedure to shut down turbines when whooping cranes are found to be within 1 mile of turbines. Additionally, Northern Divide Wind will mark the entire transmission line following guidance from the Avian Power Line Interaction Committee, or APLIC, to minimize bird collision. Taken together, adverse impacts to whooping cranes from the projects are not anticipated. For Dakota skippers, no construction activities for the projects will occur within identified suitable habitat. Avoidance will include siting structures and other temporary and permanent infrastructure outside of suitable habitat boundaries. Additionally, no construction will occur during the Dakota skipper flight period, which is between mid-June and mid-July, in areas adjacent to field verified Dakota skipper habitat. Adverse impacts to Dakota skipper from the projects are not anticipated.
Thank you. And have the projects been sited to minimize potential adverse environmental effects?
Yes. Through Northern Divide Wind's utilization of the mitigation hierarchy in project development, Northern Divide Wind has avoided and minimized overall potential adverse environmental effects.
And does this conclude your direct testimony?
It does.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, do you have any questions for Mr. Derby?
I do, just a couple. First of all, good afternoon, Mr. Derby. I think I lost your audio.
Good afternoon. Are you there?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Sorry.
You're using the term adverse impact quite a bit. And I guess my question to you is, what is an adverse impact?
Following the commission's conditions of, and I think Commissioner Fedorchuk noted that, is to look at minimal adverse impacts or effects as a standard in the decision making, and it was to address that issue for the commission.
I mean, I guess my question more is, in the realm of this study, if one breeding duck pair gets displaced because there's a wind turbine put down, is that an adverse impact to ducks as a whole? I'm just trying to get a gauge as to how you're using the terminology in your testimony.
Again, it was the terminology was used for the commission, but in a biological realm, typically we look at population level effects.
Okay, so with the numbers that I went through with Mr. Jones earlier in his pre-filed testimony, are the displacement that's anticipated as a result of this project, is that what you would consider to be acceptable for the construction of a wind project?
Yes, for waterfowl, the numbers that were in my testimony as well reflect a very small portion of the population of waterfowl in North Dakota or the region or continentally. No population level effects would be expected from that level of displacement. Additionally, it is a displacement issue that was being described, where the birds, the waterfowl in this case, simply flew. They documented that they moved. We don't know what they did when they arrived at a new location, if they successfully bred or not.
I covered this with Mr. Jones, and he deferred me to you for further explanation on it. But it's my understanding that displacement does not account for fatalities. Is that correct?
Correct.
So fatalities would be a separate category that we'd be looking at in these studies. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
What impact does placing a turbine adjacent to a wetland have on fatality rates for birds?
Yeah, I've been involved in many wind project fatality monitoring studies in North Dakota, South Dakota, and throughout the country. And typically, the fatality rates are not driven by location of a turbine or even a wind farm all the time. I cannot say, go into a project and say a particular turbine is going to have a higher or lower fatality rate with any certainty based on its location near a wetland or other vegetation type or landscape form.
What factors have you found that drive fatality numbers with respect to turbine collisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for birds, actually, the overall fatality rates are usually very, very low. For waterfowl, fairly insignificant, quite frankly. For fatalities, there was a study done in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and others that was published. It was done in North Dakota and South Dakota on projects where they had radio telemetry birds studying in the prairie pothole region, where they found only one of the, I believe there's about 160 individual birds, one of those was found at a wind turbine as a fatality. So very low fatality at wind turbines, even in an area within the prairie pothole region. So birds fly great distances, and to say that where they're at on a landscape at any one point in time leads to mortality is very difficult.
Is there a difference in mortality rate between different species of birds? I know at least the information that's been provided to us indicates that whooping cranes and sandhill cranes, for example, aren't known to have fatalities related to collisions with wind turbines. But I presume that there are other species that are more likely to collide with a wind turbine. Am I accurate with that presumption?
There's been, I don't know off the top of my head, but probably over 100 species documented as being found at wind turbines. So taking in consideration with the overall low fatality rate, this is nationally, not North Dakota, of a few birds per turbine per year spread across many species. That's part of the reason that most studies conducted by private and federal agencies are finding low population level potential impacts. So the most common grouping of species, I would say, is probably neotropical migrants or small migrating birds that at night, not necessarily ones during the day. And that's probably a lot of reason why it's hard to say, a turbine near a tree row is going to have higher mortality, is that most mortality is likely to occur at night, and because they're doing broad front migration, hypothetically, you know, that's a hypothesis. Again, very hard to prove that one way or the other, but observationally, that's what is often seen.
I just have a couple questions with respect to grouse. I know that's that's an issue that was discussed at the last hearing, and there's some information in the application about it with respect to this project as well. The mitigation measures that are offered are specifically not putting a turbine within a half a mile of a known grouse lek, and then some construction timing constraints with respect to any new grouse leks that are found in the studies done in 2020. I guess my first question is, when are these 2020 studies going to be completed?
Could you repeat the actual question? You broke up on my end.
Sure. When will the 2020 grouse lek surveys be completed?
Yes. This spring, they'll be done. They're underway currently, and they'll be completed by early May.
And I guess, will they be completed prior to the construction of any turbines?
Yes.
Do you believe that the mitigation measures that are laid out for the grouse in the application are appropriate?
Yes, they're very consistent and appropriate with other projects in the region.
And have you implemented those same types of mitigation measures with other projects in the region?
Yes.
And what has the result of those been?
There's been projects. Are you specifically talking about the half mile setback?
The half mile setback and the idea that if there's a lek found, there'll be constraints upon when construction may occur.
Okay, so the timing stipulation part. Yeah, so half mile setback from known leks is a pretty common action. I believe that's a very standard implemented action requested by the agencies and implemented by NextEra. I believe that is an effective offsetting measure or minimization measure to look at maintaining leks on the ground after construction. For the timing stipulation part, again, that's a fairly common practice in the construction world, whether it's a transmission line or a pipeline or a wind farm. If a lek is found after construction planning, to put a timing stipulation on it. What the idea is to allow those birds to complete their breeding cycle that year during the spring period when they would be at the lek and going through breeding. You do not disturb them during the early morning and late afternoon or early evening hours when they may be on the lek displaying and breeding.
Okay, that kind of segues into my next questions about the bald and the golden eagle. I know that the application indicates that the project area is not a suitable breeding ground for either one of those species. But my question is, just because a specific area isn't a suitable breeding ground, does that necessarily mean that the project doesn't pose a risk to that species?
No, not necessarily. In this case, there were very few bald or golden eagles observed in the project in the project area or even in the overall larger previous project during the annual eagle use surveys, not just the nest surveys. In the project area, there was 5 total bald eagles observed during 1 year of surveys over several hundred hours of observation. So very low incident of occurrence.
I don't have any further questions for you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Pranis, do you have any questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have any questions?
I just have the one question, and that was in relation to the whooping crane habitat for the flatwood. The biggest risk is them landing in the area. And I noted in the studies or the assessment that the generally the habitat in this area was rated as a 12, but there wasn't a scale that I could find in that study to show what would be the highest rating. So if you could provide some context there for how does 12 rank and what goes into making those suitable and what would be the Ritz-Carlton of landing pads for whooping cranes?
Sure. So that, I believe, I went back and looked at during the break at the where that came up, and I believe that's out of the original whooping crane analysis done by the Watershed Institute, or TWI, yeah, following their model. That was for the overall 300 megawatt wind farm, as well as a very wide transmission line study corridor. So to answer your question directly, a 17 is the maximum score. That's the simple answer to your question is 17 is the maximum score in the TWI model.
I would say that it's relatively attractive then, the stopover area.
Yes. When we went and looked at, there's a wind project specific study. I believe that's V7. The TWI model is an appendix to that. It's a report authored by West. And in there, we followed a slightly different approach as the recommendation by the wildlife agencies, and that's using a model that was produced specific. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if that was us. I heard a loud tone, so it caught me off guard. There's a new model that was used using data from, or comparison, not necessarily a model, from Neil Nemeth et al. And that model depicts on figure 2, again, in B7 of the wind project application. And in there, it shows relative probability of use for the project in the vicinity, as for the project in the general vicinity. Overall, there's potential habitat throughout the region, is known, it is in the corridor, but it's really very similar to other parts of the immediate vicinity and is actually a little bit lower than some of the immediate vicinity areas. But we did not use, again, working with the wildlife agencies on an updated approach. Back when the Watershed Institute did their work, the Nemeth model was not available.
Okay, then my only other question is, how far away is the revised project from the nearest edge of the Lostwood Wildlife Refuge?
I believe it's about 17 miles.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Clayton. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Karasius, do you have any questions?
Just one, Your Honor. Could you, Clayton, could you tell me, and just as a point of reference to follow up on Commissioner Fedorchak's question, where would a 17 be in North Dakota in terms of a stopover area?
Yeah, so the 17 or a 12 or a 2 is based on each individual wetland basin. So each pothole or each basin, if you go look at the actual TWI model, and sorry, I'm using some vernacular there, the Watershed Institute model, there's different criteria that go in, and each of those is applied to an individual basin. So it isn't a large geographic area. It could be a 5-acre basin that's close to another basin that's far away from disturbance. So the further away from disturbances, the closer there are to other wetlands, that particular basin gets a higher score, and that's explained in their model. So there could be a 17 score in any particular county throughout the corridor from Texas on up. I'm sure there are examples.
Do you know if there are many in North Dakota or any for that matter?
Absolutely. If you look at the actual TWI model, their report, I believe they indicated, again, this was in the 300 megawatt project in a very wide assessment area. They documented, they scored 8 wetlands as a 17. I don't know if those were in the actual current project or not. That was in their assessment.
Okay, thank you. No other questions.
Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Clayton, did I write it down correctly? You said earlier there's no turbines in unbroken grasslands, correct?
Correct.
So in our work with coal mine reclamation, we deal a lot with grassland restoration. And one of the things that has become very obvious, it's pretty easy to get grass started, but getting native species grasses started is extraordinarily expensive. They work very hard at it, and it is important to certain species to have native species of grasses as opposed to non-native species. Do you agree with that?
For some species, I believe it is very important, yes.
Okay, so your testimony is that there's none on unbroken grasslands, which I would take to mean native there's none on native species. In the application on page 1.2, it says the turbines are all in tilled cropland. And over the years, I've gotten a lot of complaints from people who are using these terminologies in different ways with grasslands. And so I'm trying to clarify here, what about the things that are in between tilled grasslands, which mean probably most years have a new crop seeded in them, as opposed to native species grasslands? What about an alfalfa field? Could there be a turbine in an alfalfa field under this standard or no?
I'd have to go back and look at each individual turbine, but I believe typically alfalfa is considered a tilled cropland because you plant it, and after a few years, you may have to till it up and plant a new cover crop of oats with alfalfa if you wanted to keep it in alfalfa. Okay. Because it is a disturbed landscape. And when I say no turbines are in unbroken grassland, a better way maybe to say would be all turbines are in tilled cropland.
Okay, what about CRP? And I'm not really too familiar with this area of Berkheim. Maybe there is no CRP there, but would CRP be considered tilled cropland?
No, that would probably be considered broken grassland or replanted grassland. And again, in this case, you know, tilled or broken grassland or unbroken grassland would be three major categories. So a wheat field, a CRP field, and a native prairie, you know, in kind of, if you were looking at it, Commissioner, on a big broad scale. So all the turbines per the application are in tilled landscapes. Ag fields, tilled ag fields, not in unbroken grasslands or in broken grasslands or replanted.
Like something that was planted many years ago to brome grass or crested wheat grass, would that be considered unbroken grasslands even though it was broken one time, or is that tilled?
It'd be tilled or broken grassland. Unbroken grassland would be considered, as Mr. Jones noted, unbroken grassland really looks at the sod. Has the sod ever been tilled for any purpose? You know, historically, was it tilled up and planted for wheat or sunflowers for many years, and now it's a CRP field or it's put into a pasture? Northern Divide Wind used a further defining category of native prairie as a subset of unbroken grassland, which would include the grasslands that have a lot of dominant native grass species and forbs, but unbroken grassland would be more inclusive than just saying native prairie as applied in this. So the term unbroken grassland really looks at the sod. Was it ever broken? And is a broader category.
Okay, so that's really the standard that was used here. So if we went and looked at each of these turbine sites, there could be some that are in alfalfa or crested wheatgrass or something like that that was broken up one time.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you very much. Good seeing you again.
Sure. Good to see you. Stay safe.
Thank you. Ms. Fury, do you have any redirect?
I don't, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Schmidt, did you have any other questions?
I don't, Your Honor. Thanks.
All right. Are there any other questions from the commissioners? All right. Hearing none, I believe that's all the questions for you, Mr. Derby. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Fury, do you have any additional witnesses?
Not at this time, Your Honor.
All right. Then I will turn to you, Mr. Pranis. Would you like to call your first witness?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to call Lucas Franco.
All right. And I see you on the screen, Mr. Franco. Before you testify this afternoon, I am required by law to advise you on the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
And being advised on the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do, Your Honor.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Pranis.
Thank you, Your Honor, and Dr. Franco. So first question is, did you file a pre-filed testimony on April 15th of 2020?
I did.
And is that testimony provided to the commission as Exhibit I-1?
It is.
Thank you. So I'm going to just ask you to briefly state your name and your employer.
Yes, my name is Lucas Franco, and I currently serve as the research manager for the Laborers of Minnesota and North Dakota, or LAUNA.
LAUNA. All right, thanks. And could you describe your qualifications?
Yes, I hold a PhD in political science from the University of Minnesota. I've conducted research in a wide range of topics, including analyzing the socioeconomic impacts of various energy infrastructure projects, from the socioeconomic impacts of pipelines to solar and wind installations. I also have a master's degree from the University of Oslo in Norway, and I've had extensive training in both qualitative and quantitative methodologies.
Thank you. And would you please describe the purpose and the content of your pre-filed testimony?
Yes, absolutely. So the primary purpose of my pre-filed testimony was essentially fourfold. First, it was to summarize impacts of an analysis that I conducted with Mr. Pranis on the possible socioeconomic impacts of the Northern Divide Wind Energy Project, depending on various levels of local versus non-local hiring on that project. Secondly, it was to look at the feasibility of using various levels of local workers. Third was to discuss potential consequences of failing to maximize local employment. And then fourth was to discuss the authority that the Public Service Commission has or doesn't have in terms of maximizing local socioeconomic benefits.
Thank you. Could you please summarize the findings of your analysis?
Yes, absolutely. So Mr. Pranis and myself undertook an analysis of this particular wind farm project. And we replicated the methodology that we've used in the past, in particular that I developed in cooperation with the North Star Policy Institute, studying the socioeconomic impact of wind farm projects in Minnesota. And first we found that if the Northern Divide Wind Energy Center employs local workers, a majority of local workers, it can have a strong socioeconomic benefits to the local community. We see that if the project employs 70% local construction workforce, it'll create 140 jobs in the region and generate more than $14 million in local economic activity directly associated with construction payrolls. Additionally, our main purpose, I would say, was to quantify the relative differences in impact between local and non-local workers. And it's quite intuitive that a local worker will spend far more locally than someone that travels from, say, Texas or Utah to work on a project. But we really want to understand in reality, what are those differences in spending and what impacts do those spending differences have on the aggregate level? So what we found was that local workers spend about three times more than non-local workers, about $54,000 we expect in spending from a local worker versus about $15,600 from a non-local worker. Additionally, when you include retirement benefits, those differences rise to about a four times differential. So in other words, a local worker will spend about four times more than a non-local worker over the long term. So again, that's quite intuitive. What we want to understand is, okay, what about on the aggregate if, say, this project employs 70% local workers versus 10 or 20% local workers? And what we found is that the total socioeconomic impact of employing 50 to 70% local workers versus 10 to 30% local workers is about 5.4 million more. So in other words, if this project is a clear majority local workers, 50 to 70%, the total socioeconomic impact will be about $5.4 million more than if it's mostly a non-local workforce.
So can we talk then about the feasibility of such a project? Do you conclude from your analysis that it's feasible to build such a project with a largely local workforce? And if so, what's the basis for that conclusion?
We do. For a few reasons, I would say. Number one, that our members have participated in building wind farm projects in North Dakota in the past, including on the Sunflower Wind project, and that in cases where we've worked with the EPC, we've had strong levels of majority workforce. So we've seen a track record of this happening. Second, projects like Dakota Access Pipeline show that when developers work with us and local workforce organizations, that we can provide local workers and ensure that that projects are built with a majority local workforce. And finally, I would say that we're in rather unprecedented times, including the spike in unemployment in the last few weeks, unemployment filings in both the construction industry as well as the oil and gas industries. So there's a large pool of available workers, and we want to ensure that there's a prioritization of recruiting those local workers to work on this project. Conditions change down the road, but we want to make sure that the conditions are in place, that there's a prioritization of recruiting local workers.
Beyond the impacts on local workers and their families of local hiring, do you believe that there are impacts on the wind industry as a whole, negative impacts to reliance on non-local labor, construction labor?
Yeah, can you repeat the question just for clarity?
If beyond the impacts on the workers themselves and their families, and those local economies, do you believe that there are other negative impacts of reliance on non-local labor in terms of the acceptance of the wind industry?
Yes, so that's a good question, and something I brought up in my pre-filed testimony. You know, one of the worries that we have, and one of the reasons we're concerned about prioritizing local workers is both in terms of what I've been discussing about undercutting the socioeconomic benefits to local communities, as well as missed opportunities to get one's foot in the door on a construction project that could lead to the beginning of a career in the construction industry, working on a good family supporting job and to have a career that can provide good retirement benefits and healthcare. But also on a more general scale in terms of the industry, I would say our worry is that when there's a reliance on non-local workers, it can tend to lead to a frustration in communities where projects are being built. So what we've seen and what I've seen in my own research and spending many, many hours at various wind farm hearings is that often there is an expectation that emerges from the permitting process for local residents that projects will largely be built by local workers. And then we see down the road, as we've documented both in North Dakota and also in Minnesota, that you know maybe only 10 or 15% of the workers are local. And we think as that sort of happens over and over again, where there's this disconnect between expectations and the reality, folks start to feel that there's a bit of a bait and switch, and it leads to general resistance towards these projects. And so we're looking for opportunities to maximize the socioeconomic benefits, which I think for the industry as a whole will create greater support from the community in general.
How would you respond to the argument that if a project creates even one construction job, that's a net benefit compared to the project not happening, or potentially even zero construction jobs because it may create other benefits?
Well, there's certainly other benefits, but what we've spent and what my research has done on this particular project and more general analysis of wind farm projects in Minnesota and North Dakota in the aggregate is to reveal the incredible amount of potential socioeconomic benefits that we lose out on when a project is not built with a majority local workforce. And so while investment in, you know, one job, I think there's clearly a difference and an undercutting of the value of a project when we don't prioritize putting local folks to work.
How does the transmission shortages that are being experienced in Minnesota and North Dakota relate to your analysis of the economic impacts?
Well, I would say the worry is of crowd out, that the reliance on non-local labor represents more than just a missed opportunity, because we are in the midst of a transmission capacity crunch in the upper Midwest. And it's unlikely that all of the proposed projects in North Dakota that are you know, being proposed or will be proposed, and same in Minnesota, will be able to go forward because of this limited transmission. And so the worry is that because of this crunch, we're putting one project over another, and we're potentially displacing a project that could have much, much greater socioeconomic benefits to the region. Secondly, I would also say in Exhibit 5 of the materials that we submitted, there is a letter from Investment Ulico, investment organization, and they raise concerns that I share about again, this crowd out with organizations financing renewable energy projects, that there's a limited amount of both transmission capacity, but then also demand for energy. And that when we're not putting the best projects forward, we're undercutting the overall benefits and crowding out potentially better projects.
Can I ask about with what you've observed, in terms of the question of how much of the variation in use of local labor do you attribute to the labor market, the location of the project, as opposed to the workforce strategy of the developer and the contractor?
Yeah, I've actually observed that workforce availability, or sort of the labor market conditions in a particular area, are surprisingly disconnected from the percentage of local workers. So just as an example of a relatively similar region, so a lot of my research has been in the Buffalo Ridge area of Southwest Minnesota. And there we've seen one project that could be 12% local workers, which we observed on a particular project, and another project not far away that's 60% local workers. So it appears that despite a lot of labor market conditions being held constant, that the effect has much more to do with the will of both the developer and their EPC. So a further sort of, I guess this has become clearer to me over time, as in Minnesota, there's the emergence of a new labor reporting standard, so that developers and their EPCs file quarterly workforce utilization. And as we've had more public transparency, we've seen a much greater commitment to local workforce utilization. So there's been, under this new standard, there's been 3 reports filed in Minnesota. And of those 3 reports, the first report, just to pull up my notes, the first report had about 12% local labor. The second report had 29% local labor, and the third report had 69% local labor. So this was in a relatively short period of time in the same Southwest region of Minnesota, and yet we see this massive shift towards a much greater utilization of local labor. So again, the workforce availability or the labor market conditions actually seem fairly disconnected from the percentage of local labor.
And what do you believe that the North Dakota Public Service Commission can do consistent with its legal authority, in your opinion, to maximize the local benefits and minimize unintended consequences of wind energy development?
Yes. Well, this relates to actually a correction that I wanted to make as well in my pre-filed testimony. Just on page 6, the reference to North Dakota Administrative Code Title 69, Article 6, Chapter 68 should instead read Title 69, Article 6, Chapter 8. So in reference to that authority, we believe that the North Dakota Public Service Commission actually has wide leeway in terms of including analysis of socioeconomic benefits. So first, I believe that the commission can consider the extent to which the project can be expected to create high quality employment and training opportunities for local workers based on evidence in the record, potentially including any local construction hiring commitments made by the applicant, as well as any evidence concerning past hiring practice on projects built by the applicant and its affiliates, or by the contractors selected or under consideration to build the facility. And second, the commission can require successful applicants for wind energy facilities to submit regular reports during construction on the employment of local and non-local workforce, in order to better inform future commission decisions and provide greater public transparency regarding the degree to which promised benefits of wind energy development actually materialize and are made available to local residents. We based our assessment on the plain reading of statute, but also a legal opinion we requested from Derek Bratton, a Bismarck-based attorney who has practiced before the commission, as the commissioners will well know, and has extensive experience in regulatory matters. And this is included as Exhibit I-4.
Can I ask, you mentioned the changes in Minnesota, the commission actions, and the resulting or the associated market changes. Can I ask if you've seen any evidence that Minnesota's requirement of reporting and the shift toward more local labor have negatively impacted the industry or the pace of wind development in Minnesota?
I have not. This is continues to be a record period for wind development and construction.
And have you, do you believe that the proposed local hiring condition imposes any undue burdens on contractors or developers, or that it has done so in Minnesota?
I do not. These are highly sophisticated, large EPC contractors, and the both collection and reporting of this data is a minimal burden.
Thank you, Your Honor. That concludes my questions.
Thank you. Ms. Fury, did you have any questions for Mr. Franco?
No questions.
She said, one second. She's having issues with her audio.
We can see you, but
Hi,
we can't hear you.
Derby. Casey Fury's dialing in. Our line got cut. She'll be with you momentarily.
Okay, thank you.
Am I back online?
You are. Thank you.
Yeah. I apologize.
No problem. Did you have any questions, Ms. Fury?
I do, Your Honor, and just a few.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Franco, I have what is marked as I-3 in front of me, and this is the study titled Maximizing the Benefits of Wind Energy. And this is the study that you authored, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And there are numerous factors that contribute to a project's potential economic impacts, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And your report focuses specifically on the economics of local labor. Is that right?
It does. It focuses on the impact of both local and non-local labor. So the spending impact of workers in general.
And when you say local labor, you're really being specific to local construction labor, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So this doesn't include an assessment of any potential economic impacts from the use of local consultants or surveyors or land agents?
It does not. In my past research, I've seen a substantial gap in understanding the impact of construction workers in particular, which make up a vast majority of total employment that's involved in a project, wind farm project construction. And so I've sought to fill that gap by focusing narrowly on construction workers. In the future, it would be useful to expand it out, but I think it's very valuable to fill what I've seen as a major gap in terms of understanding the impacts of construction workers.
And when we're discussing local labor with respect to your report, and I draw your attention to page 9, and again, I'm still on exhibit I-3, I'm looking at the last paragraph there, and your report appears to just define local labor as coming from areas within 155 miles of a project. So I assume that's just 150 miles period, whether that's in state or out of state. Is that correct?
Yes, I've defined, basically, my premise or understanding is workers that, you know, on one hand can either go to a project within a reasonable commuting distance, they can go home and sleep in their bed at night, they can make dinner at home, et cetera, versus those that travel in, receive per diems, and are staying locally during the construction of the project. So using that differential in terms of the folks that receive per diems versus those that are within a reasonable commuting distance.
And I'm just putting this in context with respect to this project. And so in applying that 150-mile buffer, that would then effectively exclude a majority of the eastern portion of the state and arguably Bismarck too. That's correct?
Well, what in terms of the reporting, our idea behind the reporting standard and in Minnesota, you know, we see that the Public Service Commission is charged with trying to maximize socioeconomic benefits for North Dakota. And so we're trying to both have a reporting standard that is, we define local as either North Dakota residents or in some cases where a project, you know, is built, say on in Southwest Minnesota, it's built on the border. We extend it into South Dakota and other places where people are coming in outside non-Minnesota residents, but it's within a reasonable commuting distance.
But you would agree with your definition of local labor that would exclude a large part of the state of North Dakota, correct?
Yes, yep, it could.
Okay. And so your report includes various assumptions and hypotheticals, correct?
Yes.
Okay, let's turn to page 6. On page 6, you've provided local spending estimates based on percentages of local workers in construction hiring. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And you concluded in the testimony that you just provided that you believe it is feasible to hire a majority of local labor for construction of the project. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so that's an assumption that I based is, or that I assume is based upon some knowledge of the availability of local labor that may actually be in the area. However, your report doesn't identify the availability of local skilled or unskilled workers for wind project construction, does it?
No, and I will say, and I'll have my colleague Steve Cortina speak to this as well, but you know, even within the Burke County and neighboring counties, we have, just as the laborers union, which, you know, in terms of laborers as an occupation, we represent a relatively small percentage of total laborers' workforce, but we have quite a few members just in that area. And we're only one of many trades that would be working on this project. So I am quite confident that there's plenty of sufficient labor within the surrounding area of the project. And again, I think my colleague Steve Cortina is in a good position to provide more detail.
Okay, but that would be your opinion based on an assumption and not an actual figure that's contained in the report, correct?
No, not in the report, but we could provide data on surrounding workforce, both union and non-union, if you would like, in that area.
I have no additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schmidt, do you have any questions?
I don't. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
No questions.
All right. Commissioner Fedorchak, do you have any questions?
Just one quick question, and that is on the issue of local. Is it your assertion here with your testimony, Mr. Franco, that the companies are bringing in their labor pool from out of state, using them to construct and then going home? Do they have like a set of workers that they take to every job site to construct? Is that why you feel this needs to be addressed? And do you have evidence of that, that you can point to in North Dakota that happening?
Yes, Commissioner, thank you for the question. So that's exactly right, that there in the wind industry, there's tends to be a reliance on a set crew of traveling workers that often go around the country building projects from Texas to Utah to Minnesota and North Dakota. And so what we've done is observed on project location estimates of local v non-local, counting license plates. Actually, when we don't have publicly available data, it's the best data that we have. And we've actually verified in Minnesota that on one project, we counted the license plates and found that estimated that only 13%, I think that's correct, 13% of workers were Minnesota workers, and the rest were from, again, places like Texas and Utah and Tennessee. And later, when publicly available data was made, was provided to us via this new reporting standard, we found that we were only off by about 1%. So as of right now, that's the best tool that we have. But I think that data collection would provide a great mechanism of accountability in terms of where workers are coming from. Because again, as I mentioned, we've seen many, many cases where one project built the same year has 50, 60% local workers, while a project in the area has 10 to 15%. So it very much seems to be choice, and we think public transparency would be a great tool of accountability.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Commissioner Crotchis, do you have any questions?
Just a couple. First of all, thank you, Lucas. You had stated three projects that you studied in Minnesota, and I think the top was 69%. Can you restate the percentages on those three studies, and then what the driving force might have been to hit the 69% mark on the one?
Yes, absolutely, Commissioner. Thank you for the question. So that data, it comes from the first round of reporting from a new quarterly workforce reporting standard implemented in Minnesota. So now they're, as part of draft site permits, is a requirement to submit quarterly workforce utilization on where workers are coming from. And so the first three reports that have come out had, the first report was 12% local, the second report was 29% local, and the third report was 69% local. And, you know, I think this has a lot to do with the accountability that comes with that public transparency, where when a developer EPC is setting an expectation that there'll be a prioritization of local labor, but then there's not follow through, as we saw maybe in the first report with 12% local labor, public pressure and frustration starts to grow, and there's a greater effort made to recruit and maximize local labor. And as we've seen in the data, there's been this very steady progress from 12% to 69% local labor, simply by having a mechanism of public transparency via this quarterly workforce reporting.
Okay, so the 12, 29, 69 would be in chronological order?
Yes.
In terms, okay.
That's correct, Commissioner.
My other question was the definition of local workers, which was in the report. Do you do any studies in terms of regional workforce? Because it does leave out, for example, on this project, the eastern part of the state.
Yes, thank you for the question. So in terms of the reporting standard that is implemented in Minnesota, and sort of our aspiration is to maximize employment opportunities for North Dakota workers. And so that includes both the state of North Dakota overall, but also workers within 150 miles. So that is something that I think we would aspire to, so that we're not, you know, pitting parts of the state versus one another. And we also think that, you know, the revenue that stays in the state circulates throughout the state, and that's a good thing for the state of Minnesota. In terms of questions about our understanding of local workforce, the thing about the building and construction trade unions is we have local unions spread regionally throughout, for example, throughout Minnesota, and have a deep knowledge of the local workforce. And when EPCs and developers partner, as was mentioned in an earlier testimony, when they partner with local workforce organizations such as ours, there tends to be a much higher percentage of local labor utilization. And that's largely because of those community linkages and the understanding of the local workforce and the ability to dispatch locally. So I would say my understanding and knowledge of that workforce to a large extent comes from our sort of regional centers of local labor unions, as well as, of course, the data, publicly available data.
Okay, thank you. No other questions.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Have you been with us throughout the day, or did you just tune in more recently, Mr. Franco?
I have been with you all day. A few coffees in.
So you've heard us discuss some interaction that has happened on this case with federal agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Defense?
Yes, Commissioner.
And you've heard us discuss input that we've received from state agencies like the Game and Fish Department, the Geological Survey, the Historic Preservation Office, and Department of Environmental Quality?
Yes, I have.
So, does it seem out of place to you that we would put in labor requirements when there's been no input from agencies like Job Service North Dakota or the Commerce Department, to whom that seems like it's more in their wheelhouse than a utility commission? And by the way, they are on our notification list. They were notified of this and other siting applications.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I would say that I would hope for greater focus on how to maximize the socioeconomic benefits, and that could fall in the wheelhouse of those institutions. But I think we, you know, our concern is that these issues are not being raised, and that this was sort of a similar evolution in our engagement in Minnesota as well, where there was not initially a focus on the sort of job impacts and the socioeconomic impacts associated with these wind projects. And based on our analysis, we found that that was there could be very different socioeconomic benefits of hiring different percentages, local and non-local. So I've generally been taking every opportunity possible to raise this issue, because I think we can take relatively simple steps that don't create a great burden on developers and EPCs, but could potentially have very positive impacts in the prioritization of local labor. So I've been trying to raise this issue whenever possible. And I, you know, would like to work with the Jobs Service, North Dakota Job Service, and others to continue to raise this issue on future projects.
Well, and I guess I had mentioned Job Service North Dakota and the Commerce Department. Perhaps the Labor's Commissioner, the Labor Commissioner's Office, is even a better example. But you said taking every opportunity. Have you raised this issue with any of those agencies and requested that they get involved and provide some input and some expertise for us on siting cases?
We have, and my colleague Steve Cortina has been much more engaged in those meetings and that outreach. So I'll leave it to him to speak to that in more detail. But we have, and I will also say that, I think it's well within the authority of the Public Service Commission to take steps, particularly around the workforce reporting. And as we've seen in Minnesota, that can have an incredibly positive impact on local socioeconomic benefits. So I would say we're sort of taking an all avenues approach of engagement, wherever we can bring this issue up and look for solutions to maximize those local benefits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Franco. Dr. Franco.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Pranis, did you have any redirect?
I do, briefly. I wanted to go to this question of the definition of a local worker, which I know has been a complicated process of evolution. And so just so we can understand the fundamental concept here, is it your conclusion that the economic impact is primarily based on where the money is spent?
Yes.
And that impact, and what you find is that impact is largely driven, the place where the money is spent tends to be where the worker lives. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So a worker who came from Fargo to work on this project would presumably take that paycheck back to Fargo and contribute to the state of North Dakota's economy in the Fargo area rather than in the vicinity of this project. Is that correct?
Exactly. That is correct.
Right. And that would still be a benefit to the state of North Dakota.
Correct.
And so your argument is that benefit is part of what should be considered by the commission. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if there's a worker who lives across the state border, say in Montana, working on a project that's, maybe 30 miles away, say the Aurora Wind Project, they might also spend money in North Dakota or that regional economy there because they live in that area. So even though they're not a North Dakota resident, they would nonetheless contribute to the economic welfare of North Dakota. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yep.
And is it correct that the local reporting requirement that you're advocating would include all North Dakota workers, as well as any worker who lives within commuting distance of the project as a workforce that each would be reported?
Yes.
All right, thank you. You listened to Mr. Harrington's testimony, did you not?
I did.
And what's the estimate that you have used of the total local workforce, the North Dakota workforce on the Emmons-Logan project?
Well, if I remember correctly, it was under 10% of local labor.
Right. And did anything in Mr. Harrington's testimony persuade you that that estimate was incorrect?
No.
Okay. All right, and then for this, in terms of regional workforce, I think you already addressed the regional workforce question. Then I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Ms. Fury. Did you have any additional questions?
I don't, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Are there any additional questions from the commissioners? All right. Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Franco.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Pranis, do you want to call your next witness?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to call Steve Cortina.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Cortina. Good afternoon. Before you testify today, I'm required by law to advise you on the maximum penalty for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
I do, ma'am.
And being advised on the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Pranis.
Thank you, Mr. Cortina. Did you file pre-filed testimony in this matter on April 15th of 2020?
Yes.
And is that testimony provided to the commission as Exhibit I-2?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. And do you have any clarifications for your pre-filed testimony related to the percentage of workforce on the Emmons-Logan project?
Yes, I do. I know my colleague Lucas was talking about 10%. So I was one of the boots on the ground looking at license plates. So I would say about 6 to 7% out of North Dakota workers, and probably another 6 to 7% from a neighboring states, as in Montana and Minnesota.
Okay. And so we know that there were, or we can infer that there were workers from those states. We don't know whether they would be considered local workers for purposes of our definition. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. So I wanted to turn to what your, just if you could start with your role within your union.
Okay, well, again, my name is Steve Cortina, and I work as a market representative for LAINA, Labor International Union of North America. My business address is 2210 East Broadway Avenue, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58501.
Can you briefly explain the purpose and content of your testimony?
My purpose for this testimony today is to first explain the safety risks of wind projects, with what the union does to make work safer. Second is to explain how to monitor wind projects around the state. And the third, to explain the benefits of putting local laborers to work on wind projects for the building construction careers.
And what's your role within the union, Mr. Martina?
I'm a market representative with LAINA, Great Lake Region Organized Committee, since 2012. I'm also a 13-year member of Labor's Local 563. My responsibility as a market representative is to include recruiting new apprentices and journeymen, signing up new contractors with the union, helping dispatch members to construction jobs, monitoring construction activity, investigating problems, and advocating for local construction jobs that provide good wages and benefits and safe workplace.
What experience do you have in the wind industry?
I spent 5 years working as a laborer and a foreman for a large energy company, construction company, M.A. Mortensen, beginning in 2007. I started off in the wind projects as a local hand on the Tatanka Wind Farm here in North Dakota.
And can you, to the question that Commissioner Fedorchek asked about the use of traveling crews on construction, can you talk about a minute about how traveling, in your experience in the wind industry, traveling workers fit in?
Well, of course, myself as a traveler, I've traveled around the United States helping build wind towers, wind projects from the ground up. And your question was again, I'm sorry.
Well, and did Mortensen, when you worked for Mortensen, was a large national wind contractor, correct?
That is.
And Mortensen employs traveling crews of wind construction workers, is that correct?
That is.
All right. And on the project, when you originally were hired by Mortensen, you worked on a project where they used a mix of their traveling workforce, their key personnel, and local construction hands who were hired from North Dakota. Is that correct?
At Tatanka Wind Farm.
And is that a standard practice in your experience in the industry to use traveling crews?
Absolutely. You do want to keep your key employees busy also, but at the same time, we do get local help from the area.
Right. And in your experience as a traveler, you worked on other projects that employed significant numbers of local workers in whatever market you were working?
I have.
Yes. And did you also work on projects that employed few local workers in some construction markets?
I have.
Right. So thank you. And so can I ask about how you got your start in the wind energy construction?
Well, I had very little experience in construction when I got the job at Tatanka. I worked on washdowns at the power plants for about 4 months before I got on Tatanka. And before that, I was a kitchen manager at Applebee's.
And what difference did that job make to your life and to your family's life?
Well, me working in the kitchen as a kitchen manager at Applebee's, it brought in income. But of course, you know, I was really concerned about my pension. I was concerned about how I'm going to support my wife and my kid. So I've joined the union. I've went to wind farm at Tatanka. And from that experience of making that money out there, it supported my family tremendously. Now we can live comfortably here in the state.
And do you think there's any chance that you would have be where you are today, or that you would have got a job in the wind industry if you hadn't been hired as a local hand on that project?
No, not at all. I didn't have no experience at all. A lot of my safety came from the union safety training. All my experience came from on the job.
Do you know other local workers in the area who were able to advance their careers by working as local hands on wind construction projects?
I do. Sunflower was one of the projects that I kind of monitored, and I helped put local laborers out there. So that right there was one of the projects. So my job is to make sure they qualify people, experienced people, and workers for that project.
And safety is a critical aspect of wind construction, is that correct?
Absolutely.
And what does your organization do to make sure that everybody's safe on a project, whether they're workers or bystanders?
Well, we actually, you know, I would say that our OSHA training that we do, OSHA 30, is very intense when it comes to construction projects that our laborers do. Matter of fact, all crafts is able to take those OSHA classes with our classes. We talk more of the big, what OSHA calls like the big four. Electrocution, trips and falls, you're trying to make sure you do the work safely. So all the fall protection, electrocution, etc.
All right. And what do you think is the importance of using local workers on a wind project? What's the economic difference in your mind between a local worker being employed, or when you were a local worker, versus a traveler?
Well, when I was a local worker, it provided for my family, and I only had to pay one household. But when I'm on a traveling, I got to make sure that I got bills back home. And of course I got bills when I'm on the road. So that per diem that they give us out there, kind of, it does suit for our living expenses out there on the road.
Right. And then can I ask about the Tatanka project, what your estimate would be of what the percent or number of local workers were versus non-local workers on that project?
So I would say that we had approximately about 250 local laborers out there, and that would include all the crafts, iron workers, operators, iron workers, and we probably had about 150 out there. So that's about 60%.
Thanks. And you mentioned the Sunflower project employing local workers. What would be your rough estimate of the local share of workforce on that project?
About the same.
Okay.
And I know that personally because I help put laborers out there, and I talk to other crafts of how many workers that I have out there locally.
What about other wind projects in North Dakota? What would you estimate is the share of local workforce that you typically see based on your license plates, conversations with workers, et cetera?
All right, well, I am that person that goes out to these wind projects and count license plates, talk to workers out there. So I know it's less than 20% of local workforce out there.
Okay. And you mentioned, I think you had the opportunity to go to Emmons Logan, and you stated that you estimated 6 or 7% North Dakota workers. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay. And do you know if any of your members attempted to apply for work on any of these other wind projects other than Sunflower and Tatanka?
I did have a handful of members apply for other wind projects around the state. Wanzek actually had them fill out applications. I actually took one person down to the office so he could fill out a case. I told him they had to do it online. So I let all the workers that wanted to apply online, but they haven't had no response back.
Right. And did those workers have construction experience or wind specific experience?
The workers that that applied was on Sunflower.
These are workers with wind experience, but they couldn't get a call back from the contractor building the project.
No, not at all.
Right. And did you have an opportunity to observe those projects that were being built to see if they had a significant share of local workers?
I did. I am the person. I am that person, boots on the ground, to check license plates and talk to workers out there.
And were those projects similarly under 20% local workforce by your estimate?
Yes.
Okay. And I want to just run through a couple of the challenges to recruiting workforce that Mr. Harrington identified. So first of all, the workforce safety requirements listed by Mr. Harrington, you heard those, correct?
I did.
And are those similar to the requirements that our local members and other crafts worked under on the Tatanka and Sunflower Wind projects?
Yes, they are.
Right. So you don't think that would pose a barrier to being able to get local workers onto a project?
No, it won't.
What about competition from the oil and gas industry? Have you found that to be a barrier to recruiting local workforce to work on wind or other large energy projects?
No, just really the opposite. I mean, we've seen a lot of big layoffs around the oil and gas industry. So our surplus of laborers, of workers are out there.
What about when the industry was going stronger? Were you nonetheless able to recruit North Dakota workers for these projects like Dakota Access?
Yes. We recruited a whole lot of people, a whole lot of workers for Dakota Access.
Okay.
We just had a lot of
working in. Sorry. What about working in a remote area, a more rural area? Does that pose a challenge to finding local workforce to work on a wind project?
Not really. I know, like I said, that pretty much describes any wind project that I've ever worked on, most of the pipeline projects around the state. It's not a problem for our members to go out there. We have a lot of construction workers who live in that area, and they don't even mind driving an hour away. They do it already.
Okay. And what about the short construction window, the season that he described? Is that a problem for putting local workers to work on a project?
No. When it comes to workers as a traveler, you know, you kind of, me working as a, for Mortenson, you kind of get those, you have to go for that money, I should say. It's the same as How can I say this? Just repeat the question real quick. I'm sorry.
What about the short construction window that Mr. Harrington described, the short season? Is that a problem for finding enough local workers?
No, it's not. It's the same as every, well, the short ones, like the ones that...
I'm just thinking, I believe Mr. Harrington was just describing basically that you can't build all winter long and build wind. So you got to get it done in one season, you know, from road restrictions off to freeze up or a little beyond, not to put words in Mr. Harrington's mouth.
All right. And your question was again, I'm sorry?
Is that a problem? Does that make it difficult to recruit local workers, the fact that it has to be done within a certain construction season?
No, not at all. Mr. Harrington said something about the one that started in May. It's not a problem at all. Our workforce, me recruiting out there, it wouldn't be a problem at all.
And so in terms of the timeline, obviously they mentioned they want to get started relatively soon. Are you confident that we would be able to, and other area unions could provide a qualified workforce, given their desire to start this project as soon as May, if they get the permits in place?
Yes.
Yes. Is it a problem, or yes, we could do it?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not a problem. Yes, we can provide that workforce. Of course, I'm just talking about the laborers right now, but I would think that the rest of the crafts can do the same thing.
Right. And is your belief, a couple of questions about that. Do we have a significant amount of workforce, both our members and other non-union, available at this time due to the economy?
Yes, we do.
All right. And have we successfully staffed similar projects in construction markets that were a lot healthier than today's market?
Yes, we have.
Yeah. All right. And then just to wrap up, do you see any reason at all that this project couldn't be built by a majority local workforce, given all the information you've heard today?
No, I don't see that as a problem.
Okay. And last questions. Many of your members work in coal-fired power plants. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Hundreds of our members work in the power plants. And also hundreds of members of other crafts also work in the power plants.
And how do they feel, the members who have worked in the coal plants doing maintenance, watching some of these wind projects get built with 80-90+% out-of-state workforce?
They're awfully frustrated. You know, they know that the coal industry is hurting, and they also know that these renewable energy projects are ripe for options that we can do. So we don't want to lose more and more work to the, you know, by coal being gone. We want to make sure that renewable energy is where we are.
Thank you, Mr. McCortina. No more questions.
Thank you.
Ms. Peary, did you have any questions for Mr. Cortina?
Just one, Your Honor. Mr. Cortina, I was reviewing your testimony, and you indicated that you traveled with Mortenson and worked on other wind projects around the country. I'm just curious, what states did you travel to for those projects?
What states? I've traveled to Texas, Oklahoma, Montana was the one I did right after, North Dakota here, California, Iowa. I have other states. Do you want them all?
No, that's fine. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Schmidt, did you have any questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Lean, did you have any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have any questions?
Mr. Cortina, I hardly recognized you in blue versus orange.
Yes, ma'am.
You all spiffed up. So are your workers, have your workers prior to, you know, this recent COVID epidemic and the downturn in the industry,
Have your workers had a hard time finding work in North Dakota?
Yes, a lot of construction has moved or been postponed to later dates.
Just recently or previous, like last season, did they have a hard time finding work?
No, just recently.
Just recently, okay. And are when you were employed with the company and you kind of traveled with them, what were the reasons why they had their own folks on staff and doing their work, versus having, you know, local folks everywhere they went?
Well, of course, they want to keep their travelers busy. Like I said before, that we want to keep them busy because if you don't keep them busy, they're going to go to another contractor. And we do get some local workforce. I have worked union and non-union wind farms, wind projects. So I know they want to keep their travelers busy. So that's one of the reasons why. I mean, I was traveling myself, so I know.
Yeah. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Commissioner Crosius, do you have any questions?
Just a couple. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Commissioner.
How many projects in North Dakota have you worked on?
What? I worked on, physically, one, Tatanka Wind Farm.
Okay. Do you have any safety concerns with the workforce that's in play now?
No. The companies, NextEra Blattner, they're real good companies, and I know they know how to build wind farms, wind projects.
You had heard in previous testimony about the job fairs that NextEra has. Do you attend those?
I heard about them, but I've never went to one. I've sent some workers down there that was interested on getting on that wind project, so I sent them down there.
So the success rate with NextEra, with your workforce, how would you classify that?
Well, I haven't seen NextEra hire any local that I know of, me doing my research and boots on the ground at their projects, like I said before, less than 15-20%.
Have you heard about their work fairs before with other projects that they've had in the state?
Around the state, I've been to a lot of projects around the state from NextEra.
You said projects or the work fairs proceeding projects.
I'm sorry, say again.
I believe NextEra in previous testimony indicated that they typically do work fairs when they are seeking labor for a project.
Yeah, I haven't been to any. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you haven't been to any of those?
No, sir.
Have you heard about them?
I did hear about them.
Before it was too late to be involved, would you say, or in advance?
Some in advance, maybe like a day in advance. Some that had just passed 2 days ago or so.
All right, no other questions. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any questions?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Steve. And did you hear my question that Mr. Franco kind of passed on to you regarding efforts to get North Dakota Labor Department or Commerce Department or Job Service North Dakota to weigh in on this and provide the kind of background expertise that we get from other agencies that are environmental or cultural resource related?
I did, sir. Me and a colleague went down to Job Service, and we had a meeting with a couple of the top Job Service representative who runs job service. They also said, I mean, they said, of course, they don't keep track of that right there. And they're not, you know, how can I say, they don't keep track of that. And I don't know if there's a way to keep track of that, if they can, but they just don't keep track of that right there.
Any conversations with the North Dakota Labor Department?
No, sir. That'll be out. Since this pandemic is going on, we've been trying to get some conversations with with Chamber of Commerce and Labor, with the Labor Commissioner Office, but that'll be hopefully here in the future.
Okay. Thank you for being here, Steve. Good talking to you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Pranis, did you have any follow-up questions?
I did, briefly. On the subject of travelers and their role, would you say that it's essential for the safe and effective execution of the project to have a certain number of key personnel that a company brings with them from project to project?
Absolutely. These key personnel, like myself, I was a lead guy and a foreman, so we know the safety, we knew how to do the job correctly. So we do have other locals that come out. We can make sure we put them with workers that have done the project before, could do it safely and could do it correctly the first time.
In your experience, what percentage of the workforce does a contractor need to be their key traveling personnel in order to run efficient and safe projects? Ballpark.
I have worked on those type of projects. Usually about 30% is feasible. 30-35%. So those are your key employees, your foremans, your lead guys, and maybe another guy or so for each crew or so. So about 30%, I'll say.
So if I understand correctly, the union does not object to the use of travelers. The objection is to projects that are almost exclusively travelers. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And then on the question of job fairs, can I ask, you work with, you're in contact with how many contractors a year, union contractors?
A lot.
Many dozens.
I'm going to say about 20 to 30, maybe even more.
Yeah. Do you know any contractors that primarily use job fairs to find skilled labor?
I do. I have been to some job fairs, introduced myself to contractors that actually participate right. in those.
I think my question was different, which was, do you find that contractors typically get most of their labor from job fairs, or that they employ many other strategies in order to build a skilled workforce?
Build other strategies.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's all I have.
Ms. Fury, did you have any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Schmidt, any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Are there any other questions from the commissioners? All right, seeing none, looks like those are all the questions for you today, Mr. Cortina. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pranis, did you have any other witnesses today?
No, Your Honor, none. Thank you.
All right. Well, that brings us to public testimony portion of our hearing. I'm going to quickly run through the ways to submit testimony one more time, and then we'll take a short break. So there's two ways the public can submit testimony for today's hearing. The first is by providing written testimony. Beginning today until April 27th, 2020, the commission will accept written testimony. That testimony can either be submitted by email to ndpsc@nd.gov or by postal mail addressed to the Public Service Commission at 600 East Boulevard Avenue, Department 408, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58505. For the written testimony, if you're representing a group or entity, the commission would ask that you please indicate that on your comments. And also, if you're a landowner, if you can identify the location of your property by section, range, and township, and which part of the project your land is involved in, whether it's the wind farm project or the transmission line. The commission is also going to be accepting telephonic testimony today, and I know we've had several people that have called in and added their names to the list, and we will get to that after our break. But if you do wish to provide telephonic testimony today and you have not yet called in, we'd ask that you please call 701-328-4081 and leave your name and a phone number to reach you, and we will add you to our list to contact you for testimony today. I will also note, in regards to the written testimony, the applicant will be given an opportunity to respond to any of the written testimony that is submitted to the commission. So with that said, why don't we take a 10-minute break, and we will reconvene at 4:50, and at that time we will start calling the members of the public that have indicated they would like to provide telephonic testimony today.